This episode of Shockwaves is sponsored by Universal Studios Hollywood's Halloween Horror Nights. Immerse yourself in a living, breathing, three-dimensional world of terror. Now through Saturday, November 5th, be taunted and terrorized tonight. Hello and welcome to episode 18 of Shockwaves. I'm one of your hosts, Rob Galuzzo. Sitting with me on the deep end of this table, is Mr. Elric Kane. What's up?
I am here because God told me to.
Told you to be here today?
He told me to be here.
Are you sure it wasn't us in our emails? And
I'm pretty sure we said to be here.
I think actually.
God told you to.
For once, I helped organize one.
Yeah.
Well, that's right. This is nice. Thanks to you.
Yeah, thanks,
Elric. We'll discuss that later.
All right.
You're such a maniac cop.
And our third, yes.
Sneezy, well, the sneezy dwarf over here.
The sneezy dwarf. No, that's our third host, Rebecca McKendry.
I just have allergies, guys.
She's blaming on the allergies.
I know.
Mr. Ryan Turk is not with us today. He's broken his streak. He's at Fantastic Fest, which means that hopefully next week you'll have some films to report back on. Let us know what to look out for.
I guess the stuff couldn't make it today. Thinks he's the stuff. He's
the hot stuff. But there's so much to talk about. We've seen so much. But we have what we consider some pretty awesome news. Our good friend Aaron Crawford, a.k.a. Aaron Cavity Colors, he's the one that designed the Shockwaves logo for us. As of today, right now, on his website, cavitycolors.com, you can now pre-order a Shockwaves t-shirt.
Yeah!
Boom! This is it, finally. We're starting slow. We're starting with the logo he designed.
But now all the girls at home are like raging because they're like, why not a girl shirt? They're always
there
guy shirts.
Guess what, ladies?
Shirt.
There's Holy a girl
cow.
Shirt.
That's right. There's yeah. guy shirts. There's girl shirts. Order in whatever size you want. This is a pre-order deal. I've sent him over a batch of Shockwave stickers, so he's going to include stickers with the first 100 shirts that go out. Hopefully we sell 100. We're really excited about that. So that's super cool.
And they're comfortable shirts, unlike
I'm
so many black
one
shirts.
I'm wearing one tonight, guys.
Oh, yeah, that's one of the Cavity Colors
wearing
ones.
Wearing one tonight.
So definitely go over to cavitycolors.com. And you know, not even just the Shockwave shirt. Like, Aaron does some really cool, unique art prints and pins and t-shirts. We all own a bunch of his stuff, so... start with the Shockwaves t-shirt, but then support some of his other stuff on there. And, if it does well, then I definitely would want to do like some sort of weird caricature of us,
yeah.
like some sort of weird wild Shockwaves.
And also
idea.
When he first did the logo, he had all these other color combinations, which were super fun. You know, we chose the one we liked in the end. So it'd be fun at some point you release a couple of those and,
mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
You know, mix it up.
Alternate, yeah.
One for every day of the week, kids.
All righty. So that's the business aspect. And of course, you know, if you're not already on there, please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and rate, subscribe, and review us on iTunes. That all helps spreading the word. And now to it. We got to talk Blair Witch.
Yeah.
I've been
holding off all week because me and Elric have been sort of poking at each other because it seems like we've got various opinions. So here we go. So we all saw the new Blair Witch.
Oh, she hasn't seen it.
I have not seen it.
Not seen it.
Which okay. I have a confession to make, but I will make it after you guys talk about yours.
I already know where you're going, but go ahead.
Okay.
I won't even start the review. All I'm going to say is there is nothing on this planet that I want to see more than the next Simon Barrett and Adam Wingard movie. So let me preface whatever I say next. By that first. And that's true. Like, there's no combination okay. in movies right now that I'd be more like, oh, cool, they've got a new movie.
Yep.
So that's out of the way. I thought it was absolutely lousy.
Wow.
It gave me nothing. Like, and I mean nothing. Like, I sat there, I went with somebody who has very fairly different taste than me. We agree on a lot of movies, but we're pretty different. We both went opening night and wanted to love it.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to be entertained, show me something fun. And we both sat there at the end and looked at each other and went, oh, wow. It just didn't do it for me, you know, for whatever that is that you're looking for. I didn't jump once. There are a lot of setups. Now, when I read that somebody loves it, it doesn't really surprise me though, because, you know, it's a well-crafted movie at times.
Uh-huh.
But my number one, Chris, and we can talk about a million things, but my number one is,
yes.
And this would be with any found footage film, the first 25 minutes. These aren't, you know, this is not a spoiler at all, but I would probably avoid this whole sequence if you're trying to avoid spoilers. I felt the first 25 minutes is setting up, hey, what camera should I wear? Where should I put a camera? And I'm like, seriously, I have seen 150 found footage films since the first Blair Witch. And if anyone even, you don't even need 20 seconds on that anymore. You can jump into them in a car on the way to location and we will go, oh, cool.
Sure.
It's a found footage film. To me, that was like a real misstep and it kind of set the tone. Okay. So let's go back and forth. I have plenty of other things.
All right. Sure.
For good and bad, I want to hear you.
So you didn't like it. I
really didn't like it.
I did like it.
Okay.
And I wish Ryan was here because I saw it with him and he didn't like it either. Yeah. And I'm sorry to speak for you, Ryan. But but I enjoyed it tremendously because, and I want to word this carefully so people don't attack me immediately. I respect the Blair Witch Project, the original film.
Yeah.
I totally acknowledge what it is in film history and how the marketing worked towards it. I was first in line to see it. I revisited it. I watched pretty much that, the Curse of the Blair Witch documentary and Book of Shadows leading up to watching the new movie. So I don't think the original Blair Witch Project really holds up. I will give it the last 5 minutes is some terrifying stuff, but I don't know if it's just because we've seen 8 million found footage movies. I still find like the first half so annoying. Huh. And like, I don't want to sit through this.
You know what's weird? I found the new ones more annoying. The characters more annoying than the original.
Well, and here's the thing. The new one, I liked it because it was basically, look, they're saying it's a sequel, which technically it is. It's basically a remake of the original, basically.
Yeah,
only
with more action.
You know, you actually
stuff.
See some stuff.
Yeah, there's more action. There's more crazy stuff happens.
Yeah, yeah, there's more crazy stuff and you actually see stuff. Now, that said, you know, I don't think it's like great or, you know, what were the quotes for it? The scariest thing?
Well, Miska has said it will reinvent the horror genre.
Twice.
He said it
twice. There's two quotes. There's two quotes from the guy that produced one of Adam's movies in the trailer. But that didn't bring people out to see it, apparently.
It's possible that you feel about this the way I felt about zombies, which is like, well, probably you probably like this more than I actually like zombies, but where I'm like, oh, no, I'm entertained. I know it's not a good movie.
Right.
But, I mean, you know, actually some of the way
now,
this is made
I liked
is good.
It. Well, I liked it because it was everything that I imagined the 99 movie was going to be. Hmm. Like all the hype and the viral stuff, like, that's what I thought I was going to see in 99. It might be a little too late now, quite frankly. And to play devil's advocate, although I like the movie a lot, Book of Shadows is still my favorite in the franchise, and we'll get to that in a second why. But, you know, the thing that bothers me, and I'm sure it's the same with you, is it's a lot of missed opportunities in the movie. Yeah. There's a lot of great ideas and concept and new
setups.
Things that are added. So, you know, I love the you know, and this doesn't really give much away. I love the messing with time. You know, like the way they get lost and setting up some new rules about if you stay over one night, that's kind of where it begins, et cetera. There's just a lot of cool stuff. I mean, they hint at a body horror thing, and I was so pumped for that.
But
and then it doesn't go anywhere.
You can't do that in a movie. I mean, you can't have all these, like, okay, it has more setups to, like, cool things that could pay off than any movie in recent memory, like where
right.
It's like, oh, that's going to be cool. My number one, and this is only a spoiler if you have anything, is it has this drone. Which is a major...
And that I loved, by the way.
The drone could have been amazing, but you needed a really great payoff. When you have something that flies,
yeah.
What could knock off
something
that
flies?
They
bring a drone that goes straight up, and then you get these amazing cinematic shots.
Oh,
but then there's
wow.
No...
That's pretty cool.
But
you could do so much with that, like showing spatial direction and where things are in relation to each other.
But if you were also going to knock down a drone, what could knock down a drone? Or perhaps something that flies. Oh, witches fly? I mean, I'm watching it going, come on, give me what I want, which is a flying witch. But no, I'd say the time stuff was real interesting. There's a lot of cool new lores that I felt were introduced that if they had gone all the way with – here's the weirdest thing about it, because those guys are not safe filmmakers, not at all. Like the VHS films feel dangerous at times, and that's found footage. And all their films have an edge to them. There's a couple in here, the center couple of this movie who aren't a couple, you know, as the movie starts, but they're like each other. And I'm watching this movie going, oh, they like each other. They don't even fuck or get naked. Like, no one takes their clothes. I'm watching this movie going,
like, Elric, they don't fuck or get naked.
If my quote was on the poster, I'd be like, they should have fucked, and then I'd be in. No. But I mean, I'm watching this movie going, like, wait, why is this so freaking safe? This feels like very G in terms of that side of things. You want me to care about these as characters and care as a couple, let's say, at a certain portion of the movie, and they just kind of like each other or maybe like each other. Mm. It's so, you can't, with movies, you only have so much time. If this was a miniseries, sure. We could grow into that maybe. I will tell you, this is my little spoiler, the movie I wanted was halfway through, because they're playing with time. I thought to myself, and I told Dick afterwards, I got really excited. I wanted to go home. Hey, let's write that movie. As I was like, oh, well, so this is her brother, right? I haven't seen him in 4 years. What if they had run into each other in the woods? And for her, it had been two weeks.
Yeah.
And you have her come in, and now you've got a brother, sister who love each other or don't even know each other trying to escape the woods. I'm like, that's an emotion story, you know?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And so because they brought up the time thing, which I wasn't expecting for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's, you know, but there, look, I'll give it to them. There was cool stuff, and I definitely didn't hate the movie. You know how you walk out of some movies like, going, oh, I want my money back.
Right.
It wasn't that.
And I like the last, I don't know, 15 minutes or so. It gets pretty tense.
It's tense. It's still, there's still things that I wish would go even further.
Yeah. Yeah. No, again, a lot of good ideas. I liked it. I wish there's set up for so much more. But I still like the second one the best.
I dig that.
And, you know, a lot of people, here's the thing, because again, I revisited all of them. And the second movie, Book of Shadows, completely out of context as a horror movie, is for people that don't like The Blair Witch Project.
Yeah,
The first 5 minutes is a great satire taking the piss out of the popularity of Blair Witch.
I may rewatch that.
It becomes a horror movie about, you know, people being in a situation where they do something terrible and having no recollection of it. And to me, that's a great premise for a horror movie. Mm. And it didn't exactly work because Joe Berlinger, who's more well-known as a documentary filmmaker, and he did the Paradise Lost movie.
I think that's why
Metallica
it was weird.
But I mean, you know, he had, it's somewhere in the vaults there. I wrote about this week. Somewhere in Lionsgate is his original cut, which, because they came in at the last minute and added like these gore sequences and violence and stuff. And he had a much more traditional version of the story, which he has gone on record saying, look, you might still hate it, but at least I could defend my original director's cut because that was exactly what I set out to do. Whereas what they put out, you know, they threw a Marilyn Manson song and there you go, the soundtracks, you know, that sort of deal. I know it exists because when I was at FearNet, right at the end there, one of our programming people went over to Lionsgate, asked them for a DVD, got it, watched it, and started trying to arrange airing it as an exclusive on FearNet. And it was pending Berlinger's approval if he would let us show it. And then FearNet went under. That has been long since forgotten. But the point is, it's there, in Lionsgate. Yeah. And that's the biggest bummer about this movie not doing well, is I would have hoped that, you know, because some people, I was at a bar last night talking about the movie, and everyone's like, I just wanted it to be like the way Alien is to Aliens. He's like, why can't a whole bunch of people just go in the woods and try to fuck up this, you know, this witch or whatever?
Right.
I'm like, that. Yeah,
actually,
be
a
cool
search party going missing would
a
be
search,
cool.
Yeah,
like, you get like 20 people and they're all going through with the flashlight.
Yeah,
that'd be cool.
Yeah. There's a lot you can
there's
do.
There's
anyway.
A lot
no,
going
I
on.
Had my, I was going to go see it on Friday night, but there are two main factors in it. One, I don't handle found footage very well in the theater. I'm one of those people who gets like weird motion sickness.
Yeah.
And if it's a basically stationary camera, something like The Visit, I'm usually okay. But the first Blair Witch, I remember being like, I'd have to look away from the screen pretty regularly to keep myself from getting like a bad headache from it. And then once the reviews started rolling in, it's hard to say, okay, I'm going to justify what would ultimately be after parking popcorn, babysitter, and tickets like $75 on something that people are kind of saying isn't so good online.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so I will see it eventually. And after listening to you guys talk, I'm thinking I might have to see it now. It might be worth the price to go ahead and check it out.
I remember the argument about the first one being a little too, like, shaky or whatever. Right. This is definitely crafted like, you know, I mean, it's still found footage, but, it, you know, like the drone shots, it's like, it's crafted more like a movie than any other found footage movie for the most part.
Yeah, there's certain sequences that double down on the found footage in a cool way.
Yeah.
The last one that really messed me up, As Above, So Below, I saw in the theater, and that one, like, I left with the worst motion sickness headache.
That one's pretty
dizzying,
actually.
Yeah, it was really dizzying.
There was a, John Squires wrote that interesting article today talking about how it wasn't a bomb, talking about the budget being $5 million, that it had already broken even, but it remains to be seen because people who don't work in the industry have, like, you know, in LA, you hear always about the business side. And the one thing I've always seen wherever I've been at companies, I remember when I was teaching relativity, the head of the school came and he would teach about budgets and advertising cost. And he's like, literally, you could spend, you have a $5 million budget and spend $50 million advertising.
And I think that
and you have to factor that in and whether a film's going to be considered a bomb to a studio. So, so I think somebody was saying it was about 25 to 30 million.
Yeah, just seeing how much they papered Los Angeles, I'd say that the P&A, prints and advertising budgets, were well beyond I'd say about 20 that's million to 30 million.
To me that they'd spend that much money on the advertise, like more than the actual production.
No, I mean, this is just how it is.
I think Your Next was a really good example of that, where they bought this movie for what in Hollywood is a very low amount, but then dumped a huge amount on the advertising. That thing was everywhere.
And it didn't work.
Yeah,
unfortunately.
Well, I mean, it worked to a degree with Your Next.
But not, yeah, I mean, the film would have worked better had they just gone off the buzz and released it straight away.
Yeah,
you know?
Honestly,
I mean, it's tricky.
It's not a bomb, but it's not considered a huge success.
But I think that kind of the model that that's all following after is Paranormal Activity, where it's, the film made on a shoestring and then millions of dollars of advertising applied nets of profits.
Yeah,
right.
I'm sure this will make its money back.
Oh,
so,
yeah, yeah,
so
sure.
It's definitely not going to be a bomb. So people shouldn't think that horror is dead. That's totally horseshit.
Oh, yeah,
you know, the bomb thing's horseshit. Look, it's a remake of a movie. So even if it had failed, horror still wouldn't be dead because original horror is always going to sprout up. Sometimes remakes get old and stale. And sometimes it's too long to wait. You know, I think that's something we should discuss at length sometime. Like sometimes it's just you waited too long.
I think so. Because you know when I was talking to a friend at Lionsgate about it, because she really wanted to know my thoughts and why. And again, it's like depending on what age you are, what Blair Witch means to you, you know, because we were with, we had a kid with us who loved it. She never heard of or seen the original Blair Witch, so it was fine. So, all right. So what else did you guys see? Because we got an awesome guest coming on.
Yeah.
And I can't contain my excitement. Go ahead, Alric.
I got to give a couple of these just plugs. I just listened to today. I'm driving, listening to podcasts. The Friedkin episode of Marc Maron. I wrote a tweet saying,
this
is actually my favorite episode of any podcast in the history of podcasting. Mm. And it's not because of Maron.
Right.
Friedkin is such a great guest on that show. It's like everything I've ever wanted to know is answered in that podcast. So seek it out immediately. Just a couple quick ones. Rewatched Elephant Man for the first time in probably 20 years. It's one of the only maybe two or three films that I know can make me cry no matter what.
Yep.
But what was so cool about seeing it, it's a Blu-ray and it's from Canal. So I'm not sure if it's an all region, but it's not American.
Yeah.
It's gorgeous. But what really struck me this time is if you're doing a Universal monster run this Halloween, like you were talking about, there are certain sequences that are directly out of that. I mean, is a direct Frankenstein references in it. It really struck me this time through a lens of being a Universal monster movie, but with even better filmmaking and better payoff,
right?
Like more emotional payoff. So that was a lot of fun. And a couple that are related to our great guest that I had never seen. So I won't go in depth on them because we might touch on them. But one I have to because you're holding the original there. I had never seen Return to Salem's Lot by Larry Cohen ever.
Neither have I.
And this movie is playing on Amazon streaming. It costs like $2. It is the very reason we have the word bonkers. It is largely to describe a lot of our guests' movies today. And we need a better word than bonkers for his filmmaking. But this one particularly, it's Michael Moriarty at his most out there, most intense. Like, you've seen him do some pretty crazy roles.
He's pretty wacky and cute.
He's almost like the director in Cannibal Holocaust in the opening shot. He's in the jungle filming like some Cannibal Holocaust scene. And somebody's like, yeah, we've got to take you back. Your son's going off the rails. And then he returns home and he goes, I'm going to take my son to this old house that I inherited. And they go to Salem's Lot. And when they get there, unlike the original, the whole town is now run by vampires. And they come out at night and they are very polite and they don't even need to drink blood anymore. They're actually pretty cool. We mostly are we mostly just drink like animal stuff.
So what's the issue?
Occasionally, well, they decided that because he's also a writer, a journalist, and understands ethnography and stuff, they want him to write their Bible. To basically write their history of their thing. And they kind of use his son against him and stuff. So you're watching this the premise is really out there. It doesn't all work. But then something glorious happens. Sam Fuller, one of my favorite directors of all time, who had never acted in a movie so besides a Godard film, suddenly pops up as a Nazi hunter. Not a vampire. He doesn't get that they're vampires. And he starts talking to the other guy. He's like, one of them's a Nazi and I'm going to kill him. He's been hiding out here. And so it becomes, basically it goes to this long sequence towards the end where they just are going around killing vampires as Sam Fuller, this old battle axe, director. So it is a lot of fun. It's one of the strangest films I've seen in a long time. And as a sequel, I'd say it might be one of the weirdest follow-ups, but it has some of the same stuff. But because it's definitely more low budget, you can tell. Some of the effects stuff is just like so bizarre. It's like definitely rubber suit versus class. So it was fun.
Yeah, I've never seen that one.
I thought I had, and I definitely hadn't. I mean, when this movie started, I was like, I have not seen this movie. And it made me fall in love even more with our guests than I thought I could be. Then I watched, I had to order this one. It wasn't easy to find. A couple years ago, they played The Ambulance at the Egyptian, or maybe it was last year. and I missed it, and I'd never seen that. It's one of Larry's later films. It's Eric. word bonkers is going to be used a few times today. Eric Roberts working for Marvel directly under Stan Lee as a cartoonist, like drawing Spider-Man and Wolverine and stuff. And you're just in New York City. You're like, what? Like Stan Lee's just saying, hey, man, what's going on? And you're like, what?
Is he in the movie?
Yeah,
as himself?
Stan Lee is himself. And he's actually drawing like Spider-Man. So you're like, what? He's actually got Marvel rights to draw some of these characters. So Eric Roberts is this artist. He tries to pick up a girl on the street. She faints. An ambulance comes out of nowhere, kind of old-fashioned ambulance, picks her up. He says, oh, I'll see you at the hospital. And come, you know, I'll come see you. And she isn't seen again. He spends the time looking for her, and you start seeing this ambulance that is taking people to some weird place for experiments. And so it's like this dark, the ambulance. And Eric Roberts just run around the city. And it's
That's really cool. It's
incredibly charming. In fact, if anything, I'd say it's probably, you know, of the vintage late Larry stuff. I can tell it's one of his best films, and it's so him because it just keeps shifting gears. You were never going to be comfortable with fitting it into any one thing. So it was a really cool movie. It cost me like, you know, $15 online to get the DVD. You can totally borrow it. Second to last, I had never seen his first film, Bone.
That's kind of a rough one.
Well, I mean, it's so funny and it's so weird, but it's like the craziest political sexual satire I've ever seen in my life. I mean, it is a hot button. And it's, I always say his name, but Yaphet Kotto from Alien.
Alien, yeah.
Basically just shows up at a very rich white couple from Beverly Hills house, and they're freaking out because there's a rat in the pool and they don't want to get in. And you assume he's the guy coming to clean the pool or something. And he basically just turns and goes, you're going to get all the money out of your account, or I'm going to rape your wife and I'm going to cut her throat. And it's said in a way that at the start is you're kind of scared about the situation. And then it just goes into the most insane level of satire and comedy and like the weirdest sexual politics.
But while it's funny, it's at the same time got these really uncomfortable racial and sexual situations going on. So you feel simultaneously like it's funny, but I don't feel good about it.
But they always talk about it. So it's never like there's not a single sliver where you could watch and go, ooh, it's misogyny or it's anti-black. No, this is just it's just looking at issues at the time and going, I'm gonna go there. So it's kind of, and it's produced, well, it's produced afterwards by James K. Harris, the guy who did like The Blob and stuff. So the guy who picked it up and distributed it. So there's some interesting stories there. And then I'm not going to talk about this one right now, but I finally watched, we all know the long history with this title. I finally got to see the Blu-ray release of God Told Me To. So it was something that we had a little part to play in, which we can go into later, but it was just awesome. I hadn't seen that film since, you know, a DVD like 10 years ago, and it was just great seeing that movie. And we'll talk much more about that as the show goes, because it's one of my favorites. But it was a Larry binge.
Wow.
Of the ones I hadn't, you know.
Well done.
Not the stuff I already love.
I'm going to do one after this episode.
That's a lot of Larry.
That's a lot of Larry.
A whole lot of Larry.
A whole lot of
What about you, Becca?
I will run through mine. So first, I rewatched Pandorum from 2009, which I had not seen since I saw it in the theater in 2009. And when I saw it in the theater in 2009, I thought that it was just a jumbled mess. Like, I was really confused about what was going on. I thought there was just, it was way too many subplots and people involved. And I didn't enjoy it at all. Rewatching it in my living room, I freaking loved it. I thought it was awesome.
Is that the one Norman Reedus? Is he in that one? Am I thinking of the wrong movie?
I think it's a guy who looks like him as one of the main characters. It's Dennis Quaid.
Dennis Quaid is in it. He's
it's
like
kind of like
guy.
A punk. If I always remind me of a punk.
It's
Event
like
Horizon.
Cyberpunk Event Horizon. There's a lot of tubes, a lot of metal stuff involved.
Ben Foster.
Ben Foster. That's
totally, it. Yeah. The whole plot is that this ship has been sent from Earth because Earth has become overpopulated, and they're bound for this planet called Tanis. And
Norman's in it too.
Oh, Norman is. Oh, okay.
That's too much emo for one movie.
Yeah. No, the movie definitely does have a good amount of emo in it. And so somewhere along the way, they all go into this hypersleep, and it's going to take 123 years to get to the planet. But then some shit goes wrong and some of the crew wakes up. But when you wake up without completing your full like sleep thing that they put you in, you get this kind of insanity that they call Pandorum, where you start to see shit, and then you realize that there's all these monsters on the ship, and at first they don't realize if it's real or not, and then it kind of goes from there. And it still definitely has this kind of twisting following all these different characters with all these different subplots, but at the same time, this time I absolutely loved it.
Wow.
So I kind of recommend rewatching Pandorum.
I just want to go back to the fact that you just said shit.
I know, right?
Followed by the word monster shit.
Monster shit.
So
shit of monster.
The next one that I watched, I'm guessing Elric will love. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you've
seen.
She
always gets this wrong, right?
Have you seen 1979 Stalker?
Like the Tarkovsky film?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, see, I'd never seen this
I don't know
before.
Why you'd be watching a three-hour Russian sci-fi movie. It's that's one of my favorite movies.
I was on a sci-fi kick this week for an article that's going up on Blumhouse, which will be up by the time this show airs. And so that's why I watched Pandorum Stalker and the last one I'm going to talk about, Mobius. So I was trying to watch all these lesser-known scary sci-fi films. So I've binge-watched a whole bunch of them this week. So I watched Stalker. So slow, so...
It's one of the slowest films ever made, but it's also one of the most tense.
Oh my God, yeah. Seen. Like, I actually enjoyed it. And I have to say, it's weird. It's like David Lynch and then a little bit further weird. And then what's not weird during the actual film, you've got these like dreams that happen, these dream sequences that get even
weirder. You can hear
me
next year on the projection booth talking about Stalker because he plans that far ahead.
Oh my gosh.
That's the episode I happen to be doing.
That's the episode you do? That's awesome.
Strangely enough. But it's you know what? It's one of the most tense things. I couldn't imagine watching it at home on TV because you have to be captive because it is slow.
I was like, I'm going to iron some shirts while watching this because I swear the shots were held for like minutes at a time.
It's very purposeful. It's by the guy who did Solaris. So original Solaris and Stalker. But Stalker, to me, is a more interesting movie because it's like the tension you feel. Mm. They don't know what's... They're going to this place called The Zone. They just keep taking a few steps and you don't know what's going to happen.
The whole concept is this guy named the Stalker grabs a professor and the other guy is a writer and says, we're going into this forbidden area called The Zone, and somewhere in The Zone there is this room that inside of it every single pleasure and dream you've ever had will be fulfilled. Do you want to come with me? And they definitely want to go with him. And so the whole movie is kind of their journey there.
Yeah, it's a metaphysical thing, but it is. Yeah, I haven't seen it since college, so I'm kind of Criterion. I think it might be streaming, but then Criterion may have just gotten the rights finally. That's why it hasn't come out because New Yorker held on to the rights of a lot of things and didn't want to give them up for needing a lot of money. So I think it's going to come out really soon. Which would be cool.
So, yeah, I don't recommend it if you don't do the slow stuff. But that said, it's really mesmerizing, captivating, and the tension is great. So the last one that I watched, I'm hoping that somebody out there in our listener land might be able to tell me where I can find a copy. It's Mobius. It is from 1996, and I can best sum up the way that I saw it this week as I know a guy. and so it is this Argentinian sci-fi film from the 90s, and it is about this kind of dystopian. I can't say it's a future, but it's definitely like a dystopian society. And in it, the subway train takes off with a train full of people on it and just disappears. No one knows what happens to it.
I've seen this movie.
And it's really cool.
It's really good.
And so then all of these people, you know, like they're all trying to cover it up because they don't want the public to think there's anything wrong with the subway system. But there's this professor who has a theory about the way that the tracks bend and it being interdimensional and what could have happened to them. And it's really good. And then once I stopped watching the I Know a Guy version and was like, I need to own this. Not available in the States.
No. Look, you know what's weird? This is really weird. When I went on exchange program to Irvine when I was like 20 years old, and my teacher told me about this movie of a director he'd met called Moebius, and he had a copy of it, showed it to us, and he told us like the guy, it couldn't get released, and then it like disappeared. But the one thing I remember him telling me at the time was it is actually about, because of the Argentinian politics, people were being, dissenters just disappeared. So if you were against the government at a certain point in the 60s, 70s, or whatever, you just literally disappeared and there's like a whole lost generation of people who just don't know where their
parents are. And it was actually called disappearing.
Right. So this is like, you've got the sci-fi movie as a metaphor for disappearing, you know.
And this definitely felt like it had a lot of political overtones to it, not knowing a hefty amount of Argentinian political history. But the society that it was set in, there was definitely something off. It wasn't like these events were occurring in, you know, your happy everyday city.
That's so weird. I haven't heard of that film in like 20 years. That's so weird that you've seen that. It's just
it just came up because I was chatting with some people online about how I was looking for these kind of scary sci-fi films that people might not know about for this list I was doing for the site. And somebody was like, holy shit, you got to see Mobius. Hmm. Hold on. Here's a link. This has never been released in the U.S. And I want to have a copy of this.
I
want to
check it out.
It's so good.
Yeah, I'm curious if you made anything since.
Yeah.
All righty. Well, I'm just going to shoot through mine really quick because Blair Witch was the main thing I want to talk about. But speaking of Blair Witch, and also we can address this finally. So I went back and watched the original Paranormal Activity just because I think it's really funny when we joke pretty candidly on the show a lot anytime a Blumhouse title is mentioned. But just to clarify, I have only seen the original Paranormal once a long time ago. and I really didn't like it, so I've never seen the other movies.
And they're all perfect.
Yeah, right.
Especially Ghost Dimension.
So point being, there's no bias here. We either like it or we don't. You know, it doesn't matter if we made it here or not. But point being is I went back to watch it because, again, I don't know if it was because of all the Blair Witch stuff happening and like, you know.
Also Peele, remember?
Peele was talking, yeah, when he talked about it, and I was like, why would he, like, let me give it another chance. Now, you have to remember that, to give context, I saw a really, really early cut of it, like long before it was picked up by Blumhouse. I know it was Uncle Creepy, Steve Barton over at Dread Central had gotten it from Oren, the director, and was really like pushing this movie. He's like, guys, this is going to be a big deal. So I got a video of it very early, watched it with some friends in a basement, and really they were the ones joking the whole time. So it completely took me out of it. It just didn't work for me when I saw it. And also the ending was really, in the version I saw, was really disappointing. They completely changed the ending from that first time I saw it. So watching the movie again now, you know, I get it. It's fun. Like I hit all the lights, got the sound up. It's fun. I don't really get into it too much because, you know, the guy antagonizes the demon slash ghost. And I'm kind of like, well, serves you right. Because if it was just happening randomly, like in a movie like The Entity, then you're kind of like, oh my God, that's scarier to me because you have no control over what's happening.
Right.
But I don't know. I thought it was fun, and I get why people enjoy it. I still don't think it's like one of the greatest.
What other sequels have you seen?
None. That's it. I just went back and watched the original.
I really want to hear you see three.
Well, yeah, I have them all. So I'm gonna now for the Halloween season truck forward and see how I feel about the sequels.
They get better.
I hear three is really great.
Two, three, both good.
That's got the other worst.
Like Blair Witch, it has some setups that are just terribly not paid off.
Right, and then the one that you like,
it's like
the marked
golden
ones.
Should be Criterion Collection. The marked ones is pure gold.
I love the marked ones. That was quite honestly.
No, it's fun. It's like a fun movie.
It's a really fun movie.
And then Ghost Dimension is like literally one of the worst films I've seen in a long time.
Wow.
I hate it. Was just like,
well, if I'm in 3D, at least I'll watch it that way.
Yeah.
But no, I'm gonna truck through. Scream Factory put this out a little while ago. I have the Blu-ray here of Raising Kane, and yeah, I know you were talking about De Palma quite a bit. Now, I saw this as a kid when it came out in theaters, and my vague memory of it was that I really, really liked it back then. I mean, you know, I was obviously a huge Psycho fan, and it's got a lot of underpinnings of that sort of stuff. But what was fun about this is it's got the reordered director's cut. So I watched that, and I think it's a far superior movie. It's still not... You know, it's still not like, you know, De Palma at his best, but it's a much better film watching that way because it's structurally, I get it. It's very De Palma watching the director's cut because he wrote the film too, and it was re-edited based on his original script. So it's kind of like the way things get revealed in it are almost like, let me see if I can pull another outlandish twist at you. And then here's another one. You might be able to see some of these things coming from your vague memory of it, but it definitely plays like a much more over-the-top De Palma-style thriller.
Is the quality the same?
They used the same HD transfer to just re-edit it into the original script. That's worth it. And then immediately after, I tried to put on the theatrical because I'm like, well, let me see how different it is. Yeah. And it, like, the theatrical's kind of a mess. Like, within the first, like, 10 minutes, there's so much already completely out of order that I'm like, oh, no wonder people, like...
The one cool thing I remember about that was that I'm feeling, you know, unreliable narrator kind of feeling, which is, like, this movie's jumping around so much, it makes you a little dizzy.
No, it's much more like Psycho, meaning that the wife is actually the lead.
Yeah.
And, like, John Lithgow in the director's cut really doesn't come into it until, like, halfway.
Wow.
It's more about, like, she's the lead and she has this romance with another guy, but she's married and she's married to the perfect man and this and that. And then once he finds out, the husband tries to kill her. And then it unfolds, wait a minute, who is this husband? He's got a twin brother. And so it slowly unfolds in like these different ways that make it much more a solid movie. So I strongly recommend the director's cut of Raising Kane. And really quickly, I'm not going to review. I'm just going to – I did a video on the Blumhouse Facebook. This week, Warner Brothers put out three Stephen King movies on Blu-ray, Cat's Eye, Salem's Lot, and It. Unfortunately, these things are like impossible to find because Warner's didn't release them to regular retailers. So they're not on Amazon, which is the way that I normally buy stuff.
Yeah.
You can either buy them directly from Warner Brothers on WBShop.com. And I believe Best Buy has them, although every Best Buy that I know of, everybody's been saying online they can't find them physically. Barnes & Nobles is carrying them. You could order it directly through them. Our friends at Diabolik DVD, they at the very least have the Salem's Lot one. And I saw some people posting today. What's that store? We don't have those here. So anyway, that store, the FY whatever store, if there's one near you, apparently they're carrying them too. You know, it's not unheard of. A couple of months ago, Universal had done.
FYE.
Universal had put out four comedies. It was like The Burbs and Money Pit and all that. And they were Best Buy exclusive for 2 months. So Amazon didn't get them until 2 months later. Rumor has it that Amazon will release them on November 4th. But if you want them now, because they're officially out now, then you got to buy them from Warner Brothers or Barnes & Nobles or Best Buy or FYE. I haven't gotten to it yet. I just watched Salem's Lot last night. I mean, they look terrific.
That's all I wanted to know, yeah.
Yeah, they look great. They're worth the upgrade in that regard. I watched Cat's Eye, which I hadn't seen since I was a little kid, and I totally agree with Ryan that Cat's acting is on point. Yeah. Best cat actor ever before CG. Really fun. I forgot, Louis Teague did it. I forgot that the opening, literally the opening, has a Cujo and a Christine cameo.
That's right, yeah.
All in one, so it's really fun. It's a fun Stephen King anthology, and I think Halloween season is perfect for it to come out. Salem's Lot is, I've always loved it. It's really long, and it's really long. And because most things that are really long are kind of boring for the most part, but it has those moments that are some of the most terrifying things ever, like the boy tapping on the window.
Yeah, the feel of that world.
It's got a weird vibe to
it. Good Halloween time, I think.
Perfect for Halloween. So,
oh, and correction, we do have an FYE. It's in East LA, just south of Alhambra.
All right, well,
there you go.
Forget it, that's Chinatown. It's not really, but yeah.
So yeah, that's all the latest. And now we're gonna bone.
Let's bone.
God told us to bone.
God told us to.
We'll be back.
It's no secret that we here at Shockwaves are huge fans of horror, on film, on TV, and especially in person. Halloween Horror Nights at Universal Studios Hollywood brings together the sickest minds in horror to immerse guests in a living, breathing, three-dimensional world of terror. Now through November 5th, 2016, Halloween Horror Nights features a new slate of unrivaled film and television production quality mazes, frightful scare zones, and a fully reimagined Terror Tram experience, all uniquely themed to today's most definitive horror properties, like The Exorcist, American Horror Story, Halloween Hell Comes to Haddonfield, Freddy vs. Jason, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Krampus, The Walking Dead, and The Purge Election Year. These mazes are scary as hell, and we'll be telling you about each and every one of them in graphic detail over the next couple of weeks here on the show. As Southern California's most extreme Halloween event, Halloween Horror Nights is designed to taunt, terrorize, and torment guests as they navigate the darkness from one frightening maze to another. Tickets are now available for purchase at www.HalloweenHorrorNights.com/Hollywood, including a front-of-line ticket option that enables guests to enjoy priority access at each of the Halloween Horror Nights mazes, Terror Trams, and other theme park rides. Advance purchase is recommended as event nights usually sell out. Halloween Horror Nights at Universal Studios Hollywood, nobody does Halloween better. Well, welcome back to the show, and boy, are we excited, because this is what the career that this gentleman has had in the industry is really something to marvel over, and definitely one of the guests that we've wanted to have since the inception of the show. So welcome, Mr. Larry Cohen.
I'm marveling over my career. Don't bother me.
Well, no, seriously, welcome to the show. Elric was just talking, you guys were talking about the events that you did at his cafe, which I thought was a lot of fun. Not only did you do a script read of one of your unproduced scripts, but you did the writer's workshop?
Yeah.
For a couple nights there?
It was like over a couple weeks, because he gave us a scenario and everyone went away and came back and read them.
I gave everybody kind of an assignment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I gave them all the same premise, and they all went off and wrote it, and then they came back the following week or so, and then we had actors.
Yeah.
And the actors actually acted their scenes out for them.
Yeah, if I'd been a better businessman, I would have kept that going. That would have been that was almost reason enough for me to keep failing at business.
We were ready to keep charging these people when you went out of business.
Exactly.
It was terrible.
But me and Larry aren't going to be in talks for Jump Cut 2. We're this part
oh,
of it.
Oh, you're excited about the new cafe.
Yeah, that's why he's here today.
I'm ready to go.
Yeah, he's good. He's dressed for success. I love this shirt.
I'm going to be waiting on tables too. You know, I got to pick up a little money out of this. You know?
Well, we're at the right place. We're at Blumhouse, House of Blum,
the House of Blum, and really, thank you so much for coming down. And we're going to delve into some of your writing career, into your movies and stuff like that. But you know, pretty much where we like to start is at the very beginning in terms of where we've developed our love of movies. And I don't really know much about your background other than you're from New York originally.
Yes.
So you know, when did you fall in love with movies and the whole creative process revolving around movies? I mean, as a kid, did you just go to the movies regularly? Or?
Of course. That's what we did in those days. There was no television.
Right.
So we either listened to the radio or we went to the movies. Mm-hmm. And in those days, the movie theaters, they changed every week. People don't realize that in those days, the big movies opened on Wednesday and closed on Sunday. Mm-hmm. They played for 5 days. Hmm. Then Monday and Tuesday was Charlie Chan, Sherlock Holmes, Boris Karloff. The Monday and Tuesday movies were the B movie nights, but the A movies played for only 5 days. And then the following week, another big movie would open, whether it was Clark Gable or Humphrey Bogart or whoever. That's what happened. The movies changed. And if you wanted to see the movie and you missed it, you had to go to another theater further away and possibly catch the movie the following week. Mm-hmm. But I was there every week to the movies. I had to go and carry groceries in front of the A&P till I got, 25 cents or something, and then I could go to the movies, mm-hmm. which is what I did.
I remember a line that you said at Jump Cut that stayed with me because the script you had read there was called The Movie House, and you said something like, my mother dropped me off at the movie theater and she never came back to get me. She dropped you off as a child and never got you or something.
Well, they moved, yes.
I like that analogy.
When the ushers finally threw me out, I went home. They weren't there anymore. So
but that's
I went back to another movie, that's all.
And, just stayed,
and I stayed in the movies until I was 18 years old.
And it paid off. And I remember talking to Joe Dante at one point when he was around that 42nd Street, it was a lot more dangerous, and that's probably like 20 years later.
I didn't hang around 42nd Street. Joe Johnny hung around 42nd Street, and I don't want to go into any of the sordid details, but I had a friend who told me that a friend of his went to 42nd Street and sat in the New Amsterdam Theater, which is now a big, beautiful Disney theater. They play the Lion King and stuff. And,
oh, yeah.
And it had been a great theater at one time with the Ziegfeld Follies. But then it fell into repair and became a movie theater, a double feature, kind of a grindhouse. This guy he knew went there and sat in the theater, put his feet up on the seat in front of him. By and by, a man came and sat down by his feet. And as the movie was progressing, began untying his shoes. and slid one of his shoes off and began massaging his foot.
Oh, wow.
And this guy liked it. I guess that's why I went to that theater in the first place.
Wow.
And then the guy unlaced the other shoe and began massaging his foot. And then without warning, he ran out of the theater with the guy's shoes.
Oh, wow. So it was a slow seduction.
This was a common practice at the New Amsterdam Theater.
Usually
people coming out without shoes all the time.
So that's how Bill Lustig got started, huh? Yeah, he's a shoe thief.
Bill has a closet full of
shoes. A closet full of shoes.
Other people's shoes. Last time I went to the New Amsterdam Theater, it was such a tough theater that the uniformed security guard was walking up and down the aisle with a baseball bat in his hand.
Oh, my God.
Now,
gosh.
I'm not making this up.
Yeah, that's a great visual.
So there you are.
Do you remember the first movie you saw that when you were young that felt dangerous or scared you or just felt like something that maybe you shouldn't have been seeing at that age?
No.
No, just all of it.
No, I love the movies. Mm. I love the movies, and I used to sit through the movie twice sometimes.
Oh, wow.
You know, you got to understand, when you went to the movies back in those days, people did not go to the movies at the beginning of the show. Whatever time they arrived at the theater, they'd buy a ticket and go in. Then you had a uniformed usher with a flashlight would show them to his seat. The movie would be in progress. And they would watch the movie, and then the second feature, which was usually a co-feature. And then you'd hear them say, hey, this is where we came in. And they'd get up and go home.
Huh.
Unless they really liked the picture, then they'd stay over. But, you know, they didn't clear the theater after each show. So it was continuous. So whenever people got there, they just went in, and then they stayed till they wanted to leave. And the first time they stopped doing this was when Alfred Hitchcock put out Psycho. Yeah. And they wouldn't allow people to go in the theater once the picture had started. But up until that time, everybody just showed up when they felt like it. It was very democratic.
Do you remember seeing Psycho in the theater at that time?
I saw it at the Pix Theater on Hollywood Boulevard when I was first out here. And it was pretty scary. But unfortunately, I was staying at the Montecito Hotel, which was a theatrical hotel. And Martin Balsam was staying there, and he was in the picture. And he told me the whole ending of the picture at the swimming pool one day.
He broke Hitchcock's rules.
Yes, I'm afraid it's true.
Now, you went to film school right when film school was just starting to become a thing, correct?
Film school?
What?
You gotta be kidding.
It couldn't have been a film school back then, right?
I went to City College.
That's what I'm talking about.
And City College had a documentary film class.
Okay.
And so you learned about documentary films. You edited a little. There was only one really good teacher. His name was Gene Milford. And he was a wonderful film editor. He'd edited On the Waterfront for Kazan and all of Kazan's films.
Wow.
He was Kazan's number one editor. And he taught a class. And I learned about editing from him. But I didn't learn anything else from anybody else because there was nobody teaching there who really knew much. They were all people who hadn't achieved much in the industry. But they had a job. Nobody else was having film classes in those days. Mm-hmm. There was only a handful of books in the library about motion picture making. Today there's thousands. Yeah. But in those days, except for Arthur Knight's book, The Liveliest Art, and a couple of others, there was nothing else. And Arthur Knight came in and taught a class, and he actually invited Otto Preminger to come in. This was a big moment, because Otto Preminger was a famous director. He had directed Laura, Exodus, big pictures. So he comes in to speak, and the first question is from Kurt Herschler, one of my friends, who starts to tell him that he's a second cousin to Otto Preminger. And Otto Preminger couldn't have cared less, so he left. That was the whole class.
Oh, wow.
Otto Preminger was gone in about 8 minutes, and he had been driven out by a stupid kid asking him personal questions instead of about movies. So that was a very aborted session, but I learned a lot from that. You know, don't go to college. Go out and make your movies. I shouldn't have wasted the time going to college. I could have been out making movies by that time, or at least selling scripts.
Did you make many films on your end, like shorts or any documentaries before Bone, or was that actually the first full-length film?
Well, I wrote a lot of movies and a lot of television, but I made a film at City College, but it wasn't anything special.
Yeah.
But it was fun. I learned to load a Kodak Cine Special inside a bag. Mm-hmm. I could do that without looking.
Yeah.
That was very exciting. People haven't asked me to do that in a long time. Yeah.
And they probably won't now. Yeah.
I've been waiting for someone to come up on the street and say, can you load a Kodak Cine Special inside a bag? And I said, have you got a bag? No, but, you know, that was the way it was. That's what I learned at City College.
Did anyone in any of the classes kind of teach you that you should produce your own work? Because I think you were pretty unique besides maybe Corman, but even unique to Corman because you wrote, directed, and produced. You wore all the hats to make your work. Did that come from anywhere?
He's
not even wearing headphones.
Nothing.
He's totally blind free here.
No, I don't see wearing a hat could help make a picture at all. Although Spielberg usually wears a baseball cap. That's probably the secret of his success. If I wore a baseball cap, I would have had a lot more success in the motion picture business.
Hey, look, you ended up at this table, sir.
I know.
Don't deride our quality.
But Mr. Blum isn't here.
He's not. We sell it big. We always tell people who'd be here.
I like you people better, to tell you the truth.
Aww.
Because that wasn't really a thing. I mean, I think maybe Melvin Van Peebles with his first one, I remember he kind of wore all the hats, writer, producer, director, but it didn't, I mean, it seems like that must have taken a hell of a lot of energy and ingenuity to pull that off.
No, it was much easier because you didn't have to deal with anybody.
Right, but you still have to find the money.
The
most wonderful thing about making movies my way is you don't have to deal with anybody at all. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, in the course of my movies, later on, we had to, because of the union regulations, I had to have production managers and assistant directors, which I didn't have in the early films. because I didn't need them.
Right.
I didn't want them around. I didn't want anybody on the set that had any authority but me. But later on, I had to have assistant directors and, you know, ADs and producers. And I used to say to them, you know, you don't have to come in. Why don't you take a couple of weeks vacation and I'll send you your check at the end of every week and you don't have to show up. And so they would. They'd go away, take a vacation, or get another job, and I wouldn't have to have them around, and I could make my picture in peace. Because very often, these people are spies. They report on how the picture's going. They tell the backers things, and they interfere with the actors. You know, an actor would get all upset, and I would say to him, what's the matter with him? Why is he unhappy today? And so I'd finally take the actor and say, what's the matter today? Why are you behaving this way? And he says, well, I asked them if they would send a car to pick up my mother at the airport over at LaGuardia, and they said they wouldn't do it. And I said, but all these drivers are sitting around doing nothing. He says, yeah, but I asked so-and-so. So I said, well, don't ask anybody anything. Of course we'll go pick up your mother. And that's it. The actor was happy after that. But it's all these petty things that people do on the set because they want to exert some power. Mm. They want to prove that they have some authority, even though they don't. So I always say to the actors at the beginning, don't ask for anything from anybody but me. No matter what it is, come to me. I have plenty of time. I'll take care of it. Don't ask anybody else. And, of course, many times the actors say, it's so nice to work on your pictures with you because we know who's the boss. Mm. And we don't have to deal with anybody else. So that's the way I like to work. You know, you go in a movie production office, which we never had anyway. I never had an office. The office wherever I was, I had a bag with the checkbook in it. That was the office. Anybody wanted something, they came to me. I wrote them a check. I'm not too busy. I'm directing the picture, but I'll write you the check and give it to them, and they go away. It's all done. No discussion, no dealing with anybody. So, you know, that was the way I liked to do it. And I made friends with even the Teamsters when I had to have them later on in life. And I didn't want them, but once I got them, I was friendly with the Teamsters. I talked to them. And most of the directors will not talk to people who they consider to be beneath them, you know? And so there's a strata on the set of authority. Well, I talk to everybody. So I make friends with the Teamsters. And then they say, hey, Larry, you don't want to eat that food with the crew. We bring our own grill and make our own steaks and lamb chops. You can eat with us. So once in a while, I'd eat with them. And I'd say, well, can we do anything for you, Larry? Can we do anything? I say, yeah, my kids get out of school at 3 o'clock. Go down and pick my kids up at school and bring them up to the set. So they'd go and pick my kids up and bring them up to the set. Or they'd take my wife grocery shopping. And they come back afterwards because they had nothing to do all day once we started shooting. And so everybody had a good time and they got along. But other places, there's such a feeling of authority and everybody looking over their shoulder and being afraid they're going to make a mistake and say the wrong thing. And who's the boss and who's going to get mad and the hierarchy, you know. I don't have any of that. And it makes making pictures really easy. Particularly when you're making people work 20 hours a day.
Now, how did you get the first one off the ground with Bone? How difficult was it to? Because obviously, once you have some success, I imagine finding investors isn't as hard. But I imagine that first film is pretty difficult to get going.
Well, I had written a lot of movies, you know, as a writer. First of all, I wrote television, and I wrote live TV in New York, and you know, there were shows like Kraft Playhouse, U.S. Steel Hour. I even did a U.S. Steel Hour, which was autobiographical, in which I was played by Keir DeLay, if you can believe it. You can see the resemblance. Yeah, star of 2001 playing me.
Yeah. I'm sorry, Larry.
Yeah,
I cannot see it.
It was wrong for the part. Yeah. But we, you know, so I did all these live television shows, and then I started doing a TV series called The Defenders, which was the Emmy Award-winning show back in those days. And I did that for about 3 years. And then I started doing movies. So, and after I wrote movies for a while, I started saying to my wife, this is a terrible career. You write these really good scripts, They bring in a director, they screw everything up, they change things, and they make a lousy movie out of it. So she said, well, why don't you direct your own movies? And she bought me a director's finder, which I enjoyed getting, but I never used it on the set, really, because people make fun of you if you have the director.
If you look like pretentious like that.
So I said, all right, I'm going to make my own movie. I got to get my money from someplace. So I went to see this guy named Nick Vanoff. He was a television producer. He produced The Hollywood Palace, a show called Hee Haw. He'd made a lot of money. And I said to him, you know, I got this script. He read it and said, this is kind of interesting. What do you want to do? I said, well, I need some money to make the picture. But if you don't get your money back, I'll write you a free script. So he gave me the money. $85,000 was the seed money. And I made the picture. And I got the rest of the money when I was finished for completion and from another entity. But meantime, Nick never got his $85,000 back. And he was such a gentleman, he never asked me to write the script either. So that was very nice.
Were you watching a lot of movies at the time, like things like French New Wave and stuff? It's because it's a Bones edgy film. It's really in your face. It's very hot button. You know, it confronts issues rather than circles around them. It just goes right into things.
Well, it's about racism in America. And, of course, if you turned on the TV today, a couple of black guys were shot down.
Yeah, it's the same story.
Racism in America is probably worse than it has been in a long time.
Yeah.
Nothing has changed.
But yet Bone is also kind of a comedy.
Well, Bone is a comedy. It's a black comedy. Now, you'd have to explain this to the distributor of the picture, Jack H. Harris,
from the
Blob, nice man who made The Blob, but is not a real visionary. So I said to him, you know, very nice of you to take the picture on. And he started to advertise it like a black exploitation picture, like a Superfly or Shaft. I said, but Jack, it's a comedy. You can't advertise it as an action crime drama when it's a comedy. And Jack said, am I going to stand in the aisle and tell people not to laugh? I said, but Jack, they pay money to see an action movie, and we give them a comedy. They're not going to understand what they're getting. You know, if somebody wants vanilla ice cream, and you give them the best chocolate ice cream in the world, they're not happy. They didn't order chocolate. They ordered vanilla. So I said, we got a comedy here. But he put the picture out the way he wanted to put it out. And, you know, people didn't understand it. One of the reviewers wrote, the most unintentionally funny movie all year long. Huh. You know, well, that was great. Unintentionally funny.
Unintentionally funny.
We should take an ad. Unintentionally funny. That's great. Some of the reviews were good. But, you know, Jack didn't have enough money to really advertise the picture. The problem is if you get good reviews, then the distributor has to spend the money to reproduce those reviews in the newspaper. And that means he has to buy a lot of space. Huh. And space costs a lot of dough. And these guys who are distributing these movies, they don't have the money to do that. So what do you do with the reviews? If they're not seen by the people the day they come out, they're never seen again unless you have a way of duplicating them in an ad. So Jack couldn't do that. He's a very nice man. I'm still friends with him today. He's 95 years old and he's deaf. But his daughter is worth $4.7 billion.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, she's Linda Resnick. And they endowed a huge section of the L.A. Art Museum called the Linda and Stuart Resnick Galleries. And they gave about $37 or $40 million to the...
Wow.
So I haven't gotten anything from them lately, but Jack did distribute my movie. And even though he did a lousy job, we became very good friends over the years. So what can you say?
Well, it kicks off this thing, which I feel like your films don't fit comfortably into any genre. Mm-hmm. They cross all, and it sounds like your love of movies, like the variety of movies, I guess I would call it Coen-esque just because it does not fit. Like your horror films will always have satire and comedy. You know, that first film's political, but it's funny and it's outrageous. It's Alive, the first It's Alive might be the closest to fitting into any box of, you know, being horror, but it's obviously still satirical. Was making a horror film something that came from a place of passion, or was it more to capitalize on the fact that you might be able to make money back on horror film?
No, I just made it because I wanted to tell that story. Mm-hmm. But I didn't like horror films when I was a kid because there was always a monster, a big bug or spider or tarantula or something running around. But the people in the stories were always such cardboard figures. And there was always some girl with big boobs, and she was a nuclear physicist. And I never could believe movies.
What's the problem?
I could never believe these things because I've dated a lot of girls, and I never met a nuclear physicist.
You looked like that.
Yeah. And so these movies were so stupid that I very hard for me to enjoy them. So, and I don't think I like the very Baroque ones that Universal made, the original Karloff movies and a couple of Lugosi movies, because they were beautifully realized, you know, James Whale, all that stuff. But I wasn't a fan of the day-to-day horror movies. I did like The Thing, Howard Hawks' version, and a few of them like that. But there were few and far between. And when I made It's Alive, it was because I wanted to tell the story of what happens to a family when somebody gives birth to an unusual child or a monster child. And that had happened quite a lot at that period with the thalidomide children and whatever. Now we have this thing with these bugs flying around biting people and giving them children who are very eccentric. Mm-hmm. And so what can you say? I mean, everything about my movies comes back again, circles back and becomes cogent once more after all these years. So,
are the ideas usually filtered from news stories, or is it purely imagination? Sit down and
I just made it up out of my head. You know, the other day, J.J. Abrams asked me. He says, "Where do you get these ideas from?" And I couldn't answer the question because they just come to my head out of nowhere. Most of my good ideas come when I'm taking a shower. I seem to do well when I got water pouring over my head. Then I have to jump out of the shower and find a pen and a piece of paper to write down the idea. And then later on when I look for it, of course, I was wet, so all the ink has run all over the piece of paper, and it's virtually undecipherable. I had a really good idea the other day, and I'm going crazy trying to remember what it was now, you know. But it'll probably come to me when I'm not trying to think about it. But all the movies, The Stuff, all the God Told Me To, they all came to me, usually in their entirety. I mean, I not only knew the concept, I knew where it was going to start, and I knew where it was going to end. I knew the whole scope and the entire arc of the picture instinctively in my mind, without any help. I didn't have any collaborators.
And you don't, from memory from Jump Cut when we asked, you don't outline scripts, right? That is part of your process.
I have to outline scripts when I do development deals with studios because they want to know what they're going to get before they get it. Mm-hmm. But I don't enjoy it.
But your best stuff when you're just sitting down on your own.
The script is never as good when you know what you're going to do before you do it completely and in detail, rather than being able to improvise as you go and go off on tangents and bring in new characters and bring in new situations and have fun with it. And then it's exciting to go to work every day because you want to find out how the goddamn thing's going to come out.
Right.
What's going to happen next?
I remember you telling us, I think it was one of the Jump Cut talkbacks, that you do your best work when you write yourself into a corner, and that's where like you feel like you really did well.
Well, it's good. You get yourself into an impossible situation, and then you have to figure out how to get out of it. Like if you put somebody in a telephone booth, how are you going to keep them in there for an hour and a half? So, and then you come up with it one twist after another. Mm-hmm. So at first, you know, a pimp tries to get him out of the booth and ends up getting shot. And then he gets blamed for having shot the pimp. And then the police come. And then he finds there's a gun hidden in the phone booth. And then et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Something keeps happening all the time. So that's fun, getting caught up in something like that where you say, wow, how am I going to get out of this one? What am I going to do next? How am I going to have some fun with this?
Like the old serials are saying, like, what's going to happen to Penelope Pitstop? She's on the...
You can't have this when you're in a committee situation. J.J. Abrams asked me the other day, when you were doing The Defenders, he said, back at CBS, how many people were in the writer's room? I said, there was no writer's room in those days. One person wrote the whole script, and we didn't stay there and write it. We went home. They get us an assignment. We worked out the storyline with the producing company, and then we left. And a month later or 5 weeks later, we sent them the script. We delivered it, and And they told us if there was something they wanted to change, then we went home and did it. There was nobody else helping us. It didn't take 5-6 guys to write a script. The only people that had teams of writers back in those days was Bob Hope and Red Skelton and, you know, Jack Benny. They had famously teams of writers. Sid Caesar had some of the greatest writers of all times, Mel Brooks, Woody Allen, all in a room. But we who wrote dramatic shows, we did it all by ourselves. And there was none of this collaboration. I don't know how I could function in a room with a bunch of writers, everybody trying to get attention and everybody trying to get their ideas into the story. I like the feeling of isolation where I do it all by myself.
I actually wanted to ask you a little bit about your writing process, because when it comes to seeing your films, especially the ones you directed, what I love about it is, you know, it starts with this general conceit or idea, and I just cannot predict where it's going to go. And one of the most telling things was when you did the writer's workshop, saying that sometimes I don't know where it's going to go. That's the joy of sitting down and writing and trying to figure out, you know, what's going to happen next. Was, you know, everybody has a different approach. Was that always your approach, even when you started in the TV days, or did you eventually develop into the idea of, I guess, trusting yourself instinctually that if you're going to sit down and write, you're going to figure out a direction to go?
Well, when I wrote television, you had to run an outline past the producers before you got to go ahead to write script. But then when I started writing it, things would happen and carry me off into different directions, then I would follow them and take a chance that the producers would like it. And they always seemed to like it, and they always seemed to be satisfied that they were getting more than they paid for. So I did that, but much more to the extreme when I started making my own movies, because we not only did that when we were writing them, but when we got on the set and started working with the actors, then things would happen that would change everything. Like when I was doing Q, The Winged Serpent, first day we were working with Michael Moriarty, who's one of the great actors in the business. I mean, by the way, the winner of the Tony Award on Broadway, 3 Emmy Awards, and 2 Golden Globes, and everything but the Oscar.
Which and great piano player in that film.
Yeah.
Yes. A little bit of piano flourishing.
Well, we didn't know that.
Oh, you didn't know that.
First day, right? He was listening to something on earphones in between takes. I said, what are you listening to? Oh, I'm my nightclub act. I write songs. And I said, wait a minute, stop. Why don't we turn this character into a would-be performer? He wants to be in show business. He wants to be a pianist in a bar or a club. And he gets rejected. And that's why he participates in the crime that precipitates the whole movie. So I said, can we find a place with a piano tomorrow, a bar somewhere? And he said, well, what do you mean? I said, well, we're not going to shoot the schedule. We're going to shoot a bar tomorrow. And he's going to be there, and he'll play the piano. We'll hire a guy to be the bartender. We'll bring Carradine in to sit at the counter. And we couldn't do that on an ordinary studio movie because everybody'd go nuts. The production manager would be calling the studio saying, this guy's crazy. It's the first day, and he wants to change the whole shooting schedule, and he wants to start writing new scenes. We're never going to finish on schedule. He's going to put us over budget. Let's fire this guy as soon as possible. So the only way I could do this is I do my own movies. So next day we had a nice club, and I think it was the Bitter End in Greenwich Village, which was actually a famous club. Woody Allen started there, and we did our scene, and it made the movie.
Yeah.
It gave the characters something, and it also gave the actors something. And the fact was, when he saw me sit down and write the whole scene for him with a yellow pad and a pencil, after that, I owned the actor for the rest of the movie. He just thought I was a genius. He was right. That I could sit down right in front of the cast and crew and write a whole scene in a few minutes and hand them the pages. Nobody ever typed it up. Nobody, you know. If we'd had problems, there was no script girl. There was nobody to correlate anything. So the only thing that was what was on film was the only record of what we came up with. There was no printed copy of it. It was handwritten. But he did it, and it worked out great. And then we used that all through the picture, and it became the kind of the leitmotif of the movie. And we used his song a couple of times in the movie as a voiceover, and it was just delightful. And it cemented my relationship with this actor. So we did 5 movies together.
Yeah, wow. Where's he now? Up in Canada?
He's more or less retired up in Canada. He's writing music.
Oh, okay.
That's what he does. He loves music. I think he loves music more than he likes acting.
Now, yeah, sequels. Going back to It's Alive, did that come from it being a success, or did it come from it and you just had another idea for extending the story? Or a little combination.
You mean the sequels?
Yeah, the sequels, once you did the...
Well, Warner Brothers wanted another movie. Uh-huh. So they said, you know, can you give us another movie? Because the picture did like $37 million back in 1974, which is like $125, $140 million dollars today. It only cost like $400,000 to make. I wish I kept half the budget for myself. So, I mean, inevitable that we'd have to make the sequel. And we had, Frederick Forrest, who was Francis Coppola's favorite actor.
Yeah, the cook from Apocalypse Now. Mm-hmm.
Great character. He was in a lot of pictures. Yeah. He was in Coppola's movie, The Conversation. He was the murderer. And he was in a picture called Hammett, where he played the part of Dashiell Hammett.
From Vendors, right?
Coppola produced it, and Wenders directed it. He was in One from the Heart, which was Coppola's movie. And he was supposed to play the part that Robert De Niro played in The Godfather. But unfortunately, Paramount said he'd done another movie, which was a gangster movie with Kirk Douglas, called The Brotherhood. And because he'd been in The Brotherhood, they didn't want to use him again in The Godfather. So he didn't get that part. So he ended up in a Larry Cohen movie.
A great one. Actually, one of the most fun sequels. You wrote about it today, right?
I did, yeah. No, I just love the opening sequence of It's Alive 2 with the baby shower. Yeah. And the character from the first movie is just sitting there. And that moment where they're like, wait, who is that guy? Do you know that guy? No, I don't know that guy. It's just an interesting way to kind of launch a new story based on what we know from the first one. So I always loved the sequel.
John P. Ryan, who played the lead in the
performance.
And he was in both movies. I went to college with him at City College, actually. We kind of started our own dramatic society. The regular dramatic society was a little too fey for our likings. They didn't want to give you anything to do if you weren't part of the clique. So we decided we'd do our own plays and everything. So we did The Devil and Daniel Webster. And then later on, I saw him on Broadway with Irene Pappas in Michael Kukianis' production of Medea. So I went backstage and I said, hey, you know, you just did a play where the woman's murdering her children and your children, and maybe you'd like to do a movie where your wife gives birth to a monster.
And you have to kill that.
Yeah, so he jumped aboard, and we made the picture, and he was a little difficult at the first. He had a wife that was a pain in the ass.
She used to be a big listener of our show, but
not anymore.
Yeah,
most of the time. When you have problems with actors, it's always some relative, and usually it's a wife who comes around and has to have some degree of authority to show her husband that she's really in his corner and earning her keep. So she's got to come and complain about everything. The husband isn't complaining, but the wife is complaining to show that she's important. So, one time I think I said to him, you got to keep your wife from coming to the set. So he said to me, I'll make a deal with you. If you bar your wife from the set, I'll bar my wife from the set. So I said to my wife, would you mind if I barred you from the set so I can get rid of this woman? So she was agreeable. She said, I won't come around anymore, just so you should keep her out. And then after that, we never had any trouble with the guy at all after that.
You married well. I think one of the most insane openings to any movie I've seen in my life is Island of It's Alive. I think that courtroom scene.
The third one.
The third one. The opening sequence. Now, like the second one, kind of has a little bit of satire. It's about sprays and chemicals. Was that what you were kind of making the underlining satire of that film about?
Well, it's very apropos today because almost every day they come up with some other product that you see on the market that's harmful.
Yeah.
And what's really funny is the commercials that they have for all these medications. You know, it used to be all the ads on television were for cars and cigarettes. Then they barred the cigarettes. Now it's all cars and medicinal products. And they always tell you how great it is. And then they go on for about 2 minutes telling you all the side effects. And one of them is death, you know. And it says, ask your doctor. Well, you try to ask your doctor anything. When was the last time you were able to get your doctor on the phone to ask him anything? I mean, imagine getting him on the phone and pulling him out of the operating room and say, what is it? Well, can I use Cloquin or not? You know, I mean, come on, ask your doctor. So it's the fact that there's so much bad stuff on the markets, so much bad products, and cigarettes were so bad and they were sold so vigorously and given away during World War II to all the servicemen free. So they'd be addicted when the war was over. And they all came home from the war addicted to cigarettes. And probably more of them were killed by the cigarette companies than the Japanese and the Germans combined. So this is terrible. And you know, all these people being dragged through Congress. And what happens to them? They get fined $140 million. Nobody goes to jail. And they, you know, they go on and do it again if they can get away with it. The cars, even, that are produced with defects, they know the cars are defective. They put them on the market. People get killed. Nobody goes to jail.
Well, the Ford Pinto case was how they actually weighed it up, right? They said, well, 35 people have died versus this much recall. Well, we'll just go with it. You know,
that's
the truth. Criminal.
And
it's crazy.
It's terrible. It's just terrible. And, you know, so these things should be brought out, but you can't do it except in the guise of an entertainment film.
Yeah. And that's where you're genius. I mean, I truly think, I don't throw that word to, you know, make you blush, but the word, idea of it being genius to being able to incorporate an idea, but
like
surrounded
that.
By humor.
I like the word genius. That's a wonderful
The shirt's
word.
Genius.
The stuff
the man inside
it,
you know, we have to get.
I like the genius. That's great.
And the stuff seemed to be a commentary on the fitness craze that was going on in the 80s and all of these weird health foods that were coming out, correct?
Yeah, well, certainly. There's always something they want to give you that's new on the market, and half the time, nobody knows what's in it, and half the time, it gets withdrawn after 10, 15 years, but this already killed a lot of people, and nobody's held accountable. They all get away with it. So I think there was a woman in Congress yesterday who was accusing, she was accusing the bank manager of Wells Fargo, telling him he should go to prison for what they did. And the truth of the matter is, he probably should, but he probably won't. They all seem to get away with it. So what can you say? Mm. So I just keep making my movies, and maybe someday somebody will go to jail. Hope it won't be me.
Now, we've actually had arguments about what the stuff would actually taste like. Like, just from watching the movie, like, what we assume that flavor is. Now, what did you actually
use? He brought some with him, so we're going to
We're just going to try it real quick.
We had it for dinner on the way over.
And everyone's looking a little lethargic. It's concerning.
It's very marshmallowy.
See, I always say it looks like vanilla. Like, I see vanilla ice cream that's just been melted slightly, but I've heard a lot of people
say
marshmallow.
Marshmallow fluff.
It was good.
How
about tapioca pudding?
Something
like that.
Not bad.
It was, it was addictive, and you didn't need to eat anything else once you started eating the stuff. You didn't care for any other food. You could just enjoy it as many times a day as you wanted.
So is that a little bit? That's a little bit of the cigarettes being addictive to the soldiers. I mean,
once you're on it,
that's all you want.
Well, they put addictive stuff in a lot of the food products to make you want to eat more of it. They put a lot of salt in things to increase your appetite for that product. And so people take in too much salt. But I'm not trying to be a health nut here. I want everybody to have a good time and enjoy life and go to see my movies.
Did you enjoy watching your movies? Because the cool thing about your films, like we said, you keep taking twists and turns. You can never predict where they're going. I imagine they would be riotous with audiences. Like in general, I've seen some of them recently with audience, but when they first come out, is that something you always enjoyed doing? Like did you sneak into theaters, you know, and sit in the back and just try to see how jokes landed and scares played out?
I used to go to the theaters at certain times when I knew a certain scene was going to be on, just to hear the audience scream, and then I'd go home after that.
Did you pay to get in?
They let me in.
Okay,
you know?
That's fair enough.
They let me in, and I usually just stayed for a few minutes. I didn't want to see the whole picture through, but I do once in a while like to see a picture that I haven't seen for 10 or 12 years again. You know, I see things that I'd forgotten about. I'm not like Woody Allen, who claims he's never seen any of his movies again after they were made.
I can't believe
it. It's very hard to believe you could make so many pictures. But maybe he just doesn't want to see the ones with Mia Farrow.
Could be. Don't blame him. One of the films that I loved most when I first saw it, because it was the most perplexing of all the films, I think, and I just watched it on Blu-ray last night for the first time, was God Told Me To. Because as you say, when you say a movie, you couldn't predict a movie 5 minutes ahead of its time.
Yep.
No human on earth could know where we're heading, but it's done in a way so beautifully. It's also stylistically, it all fits together, even though it feels like a documentary. At a certain point, it goes into a very kind of a surreal place, but still feels very real. And it also is probably, to me, it's the least maybe obviously humorous. Like, there's still humor in there, but not, I think, like your other films. Is that one of the films that just kind of popped in the whole thing? Or did you actually still have to like kind of go from sitting down every night trying to get to where this crazy movie's headed?
Well, you had to have kind of a sick sense of humor to laugh at that picture.
But Elric totally did.
But, no, I didn't.
He was cracking up the whole time.
But there is some humor to it, yeah. I think, and some wonderful performances.
Yeah,
in the
yeah.
picture. Tony LoBianco was wonderful.
The Honeymoon Killers. And is that why you cast him?
Yeah. Well, he was in a play I did. Oh. In 1970, I did a play off Broadway called Nature of the Crime. Tony LoBianco played the lead. He was wonderful. And after that, when I made the picture, I wanted to use him again, and he came back and did the film, and was a nice reunion for us. So we'd worked together before on stage, and so occasionally I've done plays, and this was a very favorable collaboration with Tony. As a matter of fact, I might see him next week when I go to New York.
Mm. But that movie is like, I don't, is that, because you talk about some of your ideas just come in one wallop, right? Is that an idea where it's like, oh yeah, it's going to be a guy shooting people, and then we're going to find out that, you know, God or demon or some intergalactic thing is beaming up women, making love to them, and sending down killers? I mean, like, or is that something that kind of grew, that story?
Well, I really started out when I went to the museum in Great Britain and saw all the religious art. And that was all over the place. And then I went to the Vatican in Rome and saw more. And I'd never seen anything quite as violent as religious art. I'd never seen so many people being impaled on spears, tortured, butchered in every way, women being raped. I mean, the Bible is one of the most violent books ever written. And when they depict it in art, because at one time the only art that was done was religious art, because the church was paying for everything. Everybody was subsidized by the church, and they would do the rape of Lucretia or whatever it is, So you just see some really violent stuff, and I'm saying, my God, nothing is more violent than religion. And then I thought, God is such a violent creature. I mean, he drowns the entire human race. I mean, every time you go into a church, what do you see? This poor man hanging from the walls with nails piercing through him. This is pretty horrible stuff. So I'd make a movie which dealt with the violence and horror of so-called God. First of all, look at the movies I've made. The stuff was about ice cream. Mm-hmm. It's one of the most benevolent things in the world, ice cream. Then I made a movie about a baby. Babies are the cutest, sweetest little things. In my movie, the baby's a monster.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, I made a movie called The Ambulance.
Yeah.
People think, oh, I'm in trouble, I'll call an ambulance, and the ambulance will come. But in this movie, the ambulance kills you when it comes. We even made, and I'm not too proud of it, Maniac Cop.
Be not proud of me.
Well, I don't think they were very good, but the script was good, I'll say that. And the idea was that a cop is supposed to be somebody that's on your side.
Right.
Well, that's not the case anymore, at least in this country now. But in my script, the cop turns out to be a monster. And a few years ago, we did have a crazy cop running around Los Angeles killing people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Remember? They finally cornered him up in Lake Arrowhead.
Well, in New York, the last year had that guy who came out to be the cannibal cop. He was going to plan the murder.
Well, that was a fantasy. Yeah,
yeah, but, fantasy thing. Yeah.
But every one of these movies. So the thing with God was just taking the same thing, something that people think of as reassuring and loving and kindly and gentle and praying. What amazes me, and I don't mean to hurt anybody, is that every time there's a terrible catastrophe, whether it's a flood or a hurricane or a massacre, there are all the families of the victims, And all they talk about is God. Mm. Boy, after what God did to them, I don't understand how they can do it.
Well, it's wars, too. Yeah, it always
comes
up.
People are always talking about God after God has done nothing but treat them in the most abominable way. So, I mean, let's face it.
And look how you treated Aztecian gods. You know?
Well, when we made Q, it's the same thing. We had we had another god that was flying around and it was doing bad things to people. So I'm not saying I'm anti-God, but I'm just saying the whole idea of our belief and the beliefs of other civilizations are subject to question, because so much crime and violence and murder has been attributed to God.
Right.
People, half of the massacres are always religious based. Everything the Nazis did. Mm-hmm. I mean, come on. Let's say if everybody wasn't so hung up on God, a lot of terrible things might not have happened. So it was worth making the movie.
Well, you also are using ordinary things. Yeah, it extends past that to your writing with us. I'm thinking a cell phone, a phone booth. I'm trying to think. There's others there where it just seems like an ordinary object or an ordinary idea.
Yeah. We had a cellular phone that was the center of that movie.
Yeah.
So that's the way I do it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I must say there's a unity to it.
Yeah.
It's not like I'm just most filmmakers just make a bunch of different movies that have very little to do with one another. But there is a thematic
connection
in my films.
When you're in terms of the producing directing side, you know, I remember seeing a documentary all about the American Grindhouse. You know, about some of the crazy shoots that people were doing. How much of on the New York streets is unpermitted? You know, the blaxploitation films you made, which looked pretty run and gun. Some of that stuff, the big parade in God Told Me To. Some of this stuff just looks, for an independent film, like stuff you could never pull off. I mean, even a studio would struggle to get that kind of scale.
Well, nobody would think that you could go down and steal a chase and gunfight in the St. Patrick's Day parade with 5,000 cops. Usually, if you don't have a permit and you see one cop coming, you quickly run around the corner and get out of the way because you don't want to get closed down. But here I said, well, if we go down in the middle of the parade, it's so absurd that nobody's going to think we don't have permission, because who'd be crazy enough to go down there with 5,000 cops and not have permission? So nobody will ask us. And I was absolutely right. I mean, it was so beyond the thought of anybody that anybody would do such a thing that we shot the scene with, of course, Andy Kaufman.
Andy Kaufman of all people gets his great cameo in there.
And Andy Kaufman, I saw him at the Improv, and I went over and said, I want to put you in a movie, Andy. Nobody's put you in a movie, and I would be the first one to do it. So I told him what the story was, and I said, well, you got to play a cop, so what size jacket do you wear? I don't know. What size shirt do you wear? I don't know. What size hat do you wear? I don't know. I says, Andy, you're a grown man. What do you do for clothes? I wear my father's old clothes.
Oh, wow.
And he meant it.
Yeah, that's eccentric. That is the
I says, what do you do all day, Andy? He says, I sleep. And then I pack my little bag and I bring it down to the Improv and I do my show. Huh. And that was his life.
Wow.
So I put him in the movie, and naturally we are in the down in the middle of the St. Patrick's Day parade, surrounded by alcoholics, a lot of drunken people down there. Right. And here's this guy running around. He puts the policeman's cap on backwards and runs over and starts blinking his eyelashes at these guys and blowing kisses. Now they want to come over the barricades and kill this guy. And I'm trying to keep him alive, you know, so he can do the scene. But he just provoked everybody. So that was him.
So you never got shut down by cops on any of these shoots? Like, you never ran into trouble?
Well, I got to tell you, it was usually magic. I mean, things happened. For example, when we were shooting God Told Me To, there's supposed to be a guy on top of a water tower firing. Mm-hmm. This guy was Sammy Williams, who won the Tony Award for Best Actor in A Chorus Line.
Oh.
And a very courageous guy. I mean, Tony LoBianco, tough Tony, was scared to go up on this water tower. But Sammy Williams, who was gay, he went up on the water tower without trepidation, and there he was. But time came to shoot it, and we didn't have the rifle.
Yeah.
So the production assistant, who was supposed to show up with the rifle, didn't show. And I'm saying, we got to get the rifle. And finally, the guy shows up and he says, my friend who was giving me the rifle changed his mind. Oh. I says, well, why didn't you let me know sooner? He said, I didn't want to upset you. I says, what do you think you just did now? I said, and now we've got a guy on a water tower shooting people, and he's got to point his finger and go bang. What am I going to do? Now, we were in an apartment building on the roof where the water tower stood, and there was maybe a half a dozen people who'd come up from down below to watch us shoot. And I turned to the group, and I said, anybody there have a rifle with a telescopic sight? And this girl says, my boyfriend has one. She puts her hand up. I said, would you go downstairs and get it for us, please? 5 minutes later, she was That's up good. With the telescopic sight and the rifle. We shot the scene. This wow. is impossible.
Amazing. Wow. Yeah. None of this would happen today.
So you got to say, God is my production manager. Yeah. I mean, there are crazy things happen. Another time we were shooting in John Burroughs High School in Burbank for a picture called Full Moon High. We had Ed McMahon. We had Alan Arkin and Adam Arkin, and we're shooting away, and here comes the firemen. Six firemen walk in full regalia with the hats on, you know, the firemen. Where's your permit to shoot here? I said, well, we're paying $1,500 a day to the school. He says, that doesn't mean anything. You have to have a permit. He says, well, the school didn't tell me that. They said, well, you can't shoot. I said, but I got all these actors here, and the lights are up and everything. Take them all down. Yeah, you can't shoot. You got to have a permit. I says, well, I'll go get one. He says, it's going to take 48 hours to get it approved. I'm saying, how am I going to get out of this one? Uh-huh. At that very moment, one of my assistants falls down on the floor and goes into an epileptic seizure. Everybody's standing there. This poor guy is writhing around on the floor, and this is not an act. And naturally, the firemen are there. That's who you'd usually call. So next thing, they got the stretcher in. They're tying the guy down. They're taking the guy out. And the fire chief is standing there looking at me, and I'm looking at him. And he hits me on the shoulder, and he says, go shoot your movie.
Wow.
And that was it. I mean, how could that happen? How could that happen?
Someone's looking out for you.
I'm telling you. The poor guy who had the fit never came back, but I did pay him for an extra week.
He's okay. I have a couple of quick questions from our Facebook page, if that's cool.
Yeah.
These are both coming from J. Angel Sierra, who was very excited that you were coming on the show. The first one, and I didn't know this, we know that you did Return to Salem's Lot, but he's asking, what was his adaptation of Salem's Lot like because he was hired to adapt the original one when it was going to be a theatrical movie? Is that true?
Originally, I wrote a screenplay for the theatrical version of the original Salem's Lot.
Really? I didn't know that.
It was never used. But they did pay me. Mm-hmm. And they didn't like it, I guess. I don't know. But or else they decided they just wanted to do it for television. And they did it as a a 3 or 4 or 5 part television series. And and then years later, I think they did it again. Many years later.
Yeah.
But I came along at a time when Warner Brothers was considering having a division to make movies for video. And so they said to me, you can make another It's Alive movie, and you can make another one of our projects. I said, can I make a Return to the House of Wax? They said, no, you can't have that title, but you can have Salem's Lot. So I said, okay, I'll come up with something for Salem's Lot. So I went home and wrote an entirely different Salem's Lot, which was only thing that was in common with the original was that it was a town with vampires in it. Mm-hmm. But there were different kinds of vampires. In mine, they were all American vampires. You know, they came over on the Mayflower or thereabouts. And
when they didn't, I was telling them before that they weren't drinking blood. Like they're at a point where they didn't need human blood for right now, you know.
They drank cow's blood.
Yeah, that was like a perk occasionally.
Except on a holiday when they drink human blood. Yeah. So anyway, it was a good script. I thought I did a good job, and they gave me the go-ahead to make the picture, and we had a good time shooting it up there in Peacham, Vermont. We actually shot like 24 hours a day one night.
Wow.
We actually went all night long because the picture took place at night, so the initial call was at sundown, and we shot the whole night, and then we shot the whole day, and then we shot the night again after that. And the town of Peacham, Vermont, the people said to me at the end, we were very happy when you came here, and we are very happy you're leaving. We disrupted the entire town.
How did you get, because we talked about Sam Fuller before you got here, another writer, producer, director, and somebody who was always in charge of his films and, you know, Shock Carter and Naked, I think Naked Kiss is one of those really powerful flicks, but how did you, was he someone you knew to get him in that film?
No, actually, it was really coincidental because I had bought a house in Beverly Hills, and a couple of acres, a beautiful mansion built in 1929 by the Hearst family.
Oh, wow.
And when John Ireland, the actor, came up to read for a part, he said, well, I've been here before, you know. This used to be Sam Fuller's house.
Wow.
So I said, you mean Sam Fuller lived in this house? I couldn't believe it. So then a few months later, I was at a party at the Beverly Hills Hotel, and there was Sam Fuller. So I said, wait a minute. I got a house that you used to live in. Well, he was delighted. He says his new wife had never seen the house. Could he bring her up? So they came up, and we became fast friends, and we hung out a lot, and then we went to Paris where he lived, and we saw him in Paris for a long time. And when my daughter was in Paris, they helped look after her for a while. And then Sam, you know, was not getting any pictures anymore. And I thought, wait, I'll write him a part in this movie. And that way he'll come back to the States and I get to spend a month with him or 6 weeks. Usually people give him parts in movies like Wim Wenders, where he works for one day.
Yeah.
Or he works for 2 or 3 hours. And
Perrault LeFou, do you remember that? And the Godard picture?
Yeah.
He has that one great line about, you know, film being battle.
So I said, wait a minute. So I sent him the script. He called me up. He says, you know, it's an awful lot of lines to learn here. I said, Sam, you're in 40 minutes of the movie. You've got, you know, you got to come back here. And he didn't need money at that time because his daughter was ill. And he had to pay a lot of medical bills. So he came back. And we had a very good time up in Vermont. And as I said, we shot so many hours every day that he was an exemplary figure because Sam was sly. When no one was looking, he'd get a car and go back to the hotel. And he'd jump in the shower and he'd shave. And then he'd comb his hair and put his clothes back on and come back to the set. And nobody really knew he'd been gone. And he looked so fresh. And he looked so cool. So, you know, he looked so, you know, invigorated for the whole, and the rest of the crew, they couldn't complain because this old man was able to go forward and do everything without faltering a bit. And so he was a big help to me. I really appreciate it. We loved each other. We were such good friends, and I stayed with Sam. And Sam and I, last time I saw him, he had a stroke. And they were having a party for him at the Rawley Studios. And Angie Dickinson came and Robert Stack and a lot of people from been in his movies. And Sam couldn't talk anymore because he'd had the stroke. So everything was babble. But he wouldn't shut up. He just sat there surrounded by people talking gibberish. And everybody's sitting there smiling and nodding and having a wonderful time. And he had no idea. Nobody knew what he was saying. But that's the last time I saw him when I gave him a big hug and kiss. He was just a delightful guy to know.
Yeah.
Wow.
Incredible. And there's a great documentary on him. Did you see that? The one where they're. They narrate a lot of stories from his life. It's,
you know,
it's really nice.
I stole my TV series Branded from his movie I Shot Jesse James. He made a picture about Bob Ford, who killed Jesse James and was branded a coward. And I did a TV series where Chuck Connors was branded a coward. A TV series that's been celebrated by the Coen brothers in that movie, The Great Lebowski, where Jeff Bridges and John Goodman sing the theme song from Branded.
Oh, wow.
Weird, great trivia.
They do. And then they go to see the creator of Branded. They say, well, we got to go see the creator of Branded because he wrote all the early episodes. That's me. So they go to the house, and there he is. He's in an iron lung. And while they're there, he dies.
That's right.
In The Great Lebowski.
They didn't even ask you to play the role?
Yeah.
They didn't ask me anything about it, and I didn't know about it for years until somebody finally told me, hey, you're in The Great Lebowski. And then I finally saw the movie.
It was
hilarious.
That's a piece of trivia.
They
didn't
killed
know.
Me.
Yeah. That's good trivia.
I'm glad you're still here.
Yeah.
You know why the Coen brothers
killed me? With no iron lung.
Yeah.
The Coen brothers killed me because they don't like the way I spell Coen.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know what's funny about that? Actually, this never entered my mind, but I can't think of anybody more similar in terms of storytelling. You don't make the same movies, but in that same unclassifiable, it jumps genres, but it works.
And
way,
somehow
you know?
Always a weird vein of humor.
Yeah, there's always, yeah, and even in the darkest moments.
I wish I'd made Fargo.
Yeah. It's an amazing
But it's very
film.
Much my kind of picture.
Yeah.
Have you watched the show? The show is fantastic.
Oh, the Fargo series? TV series, one of my favorites.
Yeah, yeah. Best writing. That second series, incredible. Mm-hmm. What other ones from
the second question was about Cue the Winged Serpent. Was the change of the original ending to Cue the Winged Serpent purely for budgetary reasons? According to the script on file at the Margaret Hedrick Library, he had throngs of people gathering to worship the serpent in Central Park.
Wow, that's a specific question.
Is that the original ending? Shooting anything in Central Park sounds like a nightmare to me.
Yeah.
Well, we did shoot something in Central Park, but it didn't have anything to do with that. But God only knows what the ending was of the picture when I wrote it, because when we made the picture, we more or less changed everything as we went along, because... I was in complete control and in charge of everything. I didn't have to ask anybody's permission. I don't think I looked at the script. Huh. I mean, as I've said, some of the time we don't have a script girl, and some of the times we do. And when we do, I usually take her aside and say, "Now, do me a favor. Make me read the script. When you see me doing the scene, make me go step aside and read the script, because I'm going to come up with all kinds of new stuff, and I might leave something out that I had come up with before that could be very important. So make me read the scene, even though I'm doing something completely different or move the location to some other place." And sometimes they do, and sometimes they're scared and they don't. But, I never remember exactly what I wrote originally after I've made the film. The film as it's made is indelible in my mind, but I don't remember all the details of what was left out. And obviously, probably what I put in was better.
I heard, I can't remember if this one was true, but I heard that the French director Gaspar Noé had approached you about remaking God Told Me To, which is the last movie I could imagine someone remaking. But
Well, Gaspar and I had breakfast one day in New York City. He came to see me, and we went out and we had a very nice coffee and crullers and, the French pastries. And... I never heard from him again after that. So,
but that was the title he was interested in?
He was interested in God Told Me To, and I said, sure. I didn't know much about it. He gave me a couple of his movies to look at, and frankly, I thought that it were a little on the obscene side, frankly.
What do you mean, irreversible?
No, not irreversible.
Hard to
come on.
That's an intense movie.
They were pretty raw.
Oh, yeah.
They were pretty raw, and that wouldn't have stopped me from letting him make the picture, but it just wasn't my kind of picture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's all.
They certainly don't have humor. I'll say that about that. That's one of those things that his films are so gritty, but they are humorless.
Even imagine a Gaspar Noé God Told Me To?
It would be so bleak.
Like my mind can't comprehend that.
Well, I think,
God bless him. I mean, he's just not my kind of picture maker.
Are there still contemporary, like, besides a lot of people go back and watch the movies they, grew up watching and prefer watching, are there still contemporary films that we, obviously, you're just talking about Fargo, are there contemporary directors that you do stay up to date with what they're making? And
I go to see most of the new movies, and of course the Academy sends me all the new movies in the mail, and I see them and all that stuff, and I see some of the horror movies, but not many. I'm not much for slasher movies.
Yeah.
And I'm not much for torture or cruelty, I'm always looking for something that has something to say and also explores the human condition. Because It's Alive, for example, has wonderful acting in it.
Yeah.
I mean, there is a scene at the end of the film in the tunnels where the father reaches out to the child, where some people have actually cried.
Yeah, we did a show a long time ago, our favorite horror film performances, and that was... right at the top of mine, I think it's one of the most moving characters, and if it's to ground reality of a horror film like that with a character like that is saying something, I think.
Yeah.
It's pretty great. What about, is it frustrating as somebody who's always been so much in control of your pictures? One of my favorite scripts of yours is actually a bestseller. I think that's a great script. Phone Booth obviously, did great, and that was Joel Schumacher. Is it a frustrating experience? I'm sure sometimes it works out, but being a writer when your script isn't controlled by you anymore when somebody else directs the picture.
Well, you have to take good with bad.
Yeah.
If you take the money, then they have the script and they're going to do what they want with it. And if you don't want them to do that, you don't have to take their money. Mm. But sometimes you do and you hope for the best. With Bestseller, it was a terrific movie up until the last 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And they ruined the movie.
Yeah.
I told them that we're ruining the movie and they wouldn't listen to me. I said, no little girl is going to run downstairs towards someone who's shooting a gun.
Yeah.
I said, all you got to do is cut the gunshots off. Take the gunshots off the track. And then she's running down the stairs. It makes some sense. But aside from that, it's terrible. And sure enough, when the picture played on Broadway, there was a big audience. And a large portion of the audience was a black audience. Mm. And one thing is true, a black audience will tell you what they think.
They don't need scorecards.
If they don't like it, they're going to tell you. And when that little girl ran down the stairs into the arms of the villain who was shooting a gun, voices started coming out of the darkness. Kill that stupid little bitch.
Wow.
I mean, and it really ruined the movie. And it was exactly what I told the producers. Please fix it. And they wouldn't listen. Just because they were the producers and I wasn't. And that's the way it is.
What about fellow New Yorker? I didn't actually know you had anything to do with this, so maybe it's very minor, but Abel Ferrara, it said you did the story of Body Snatchers, yeah. Which is like the third one.
I love. I always thought that Body Snatchers
That was
great.
Actually a good movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's a really good one.
It was my idea that the pod people end up on a military base. Oh. Because I figured on a military base, you wouldn't be able to tell the pod people from the regular people. Because everybody in the Army is a pod person,
yeah.
In a way.
Right.
And that was the concept that I sold to Warner Brothers. Then they brought him on. I never had anything to do with him.
Oh, okay. And
he made the picture, and it was a pretty good film.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was certainly better than the last one they made at Warner Brothers with... big budget version.
The Donald Sutherland? Yeah.
No. He said
Yeah. That one's terrible. I love the. You've seen the Donald Sutherland one,
that
too.
That was really
That's
good.
A great. Yeah, Kaufman picture is a great one.
So, you know, we did the best we could, and I only got story credit on that, but it was all right. I mean, at least the picture got made, and I did sell the script. And with Phone Booth, Schumacher did a good job, and I'll give him credit for this. I came to the set and watched them shooting. And I said, you know, the guy who's doing the voice of the sniper, it's no good. He's a good actor, but he doesn't have an interesting voice. It's ruining the picture. So I went to Fox and I told the Fox executives, and they said, oh, you can't say that. You can't tell that to Joel Schumacher. He'll have a screaming fit. You're challenging his choice of actor. I said, yes, but you're the producers over here, Fox Searchlight, Fox 2000, rather, pardon me. And they said, oh, you can't do that. I said, well, I can do it. Nothing's going to stop me from doing it. I'm doing it. So I went to him and I told him. And he said, you really think so? And I said, yes. He said, okay. He picked up the phone and called Kiefer Sutherland. The next day, the part was changed. And it made the movie. Kiefer Sutherland's voice made the movie.
You can identify.
Then when the picture was finished... I didn't like the music. So I went back to him again. I said, you know something? This is a really good movie. It deserves a better score than you have. Get a different composer. He said, you really think so? The exact same words. I said, yes. He went and hired another composer. And so I can't fault him because I asked him for two things and he did them.
He was open to it, yeah.
Which good. They didn't do on Bestseller. So what can you say? All you can ask for people to give you an honest hearing and then make their own choice. And in this case, he made the right choice. I would have shot the picture in New York, frankly, if I had made it, and in the middle of a lot of chaos,
yeah,
like on 8th Avenue. And I would have shot it at night, because at night you could get the streets locked off in New York. You can't do that during the day. And that's the way I would have done it. But the way Joel did it was okay, and Colin Farrell was good. And, you know, we went through all kinds of actors. We had Jim Carrey in it for one time.
Then
Will Smith was in it before that. And before that, it was Mel Gibson. I spent a week with Mel Gibson out at Warner Brothers working on the script. And he made a lot of contributions to the script. And I said to him, whether you do the picture or not, Mel, I'm going to keep your ideas. And he said, okay, you can do that. And he did. He added a lot to it. So
interesting.
He was extremely prepared. When I got to the office, he had an entire diorama built of the street. he'd sent someone over to New York City and photographed it from all directions.
Wow.
And made a whole diorama. He had an expert from the FBI there and somebody from the telephone company. He really did a lot, but he ended up not doing the picture. So what can I say?
You mentioned one thing I have to ask you about, because I know Rob might not know this, but he's going to be interested in it, is you said you mentioned composers, and what was your relationship with Bernard Herrmann?
Oh, yeah.
Because I know you'd worked together, but I think was it more a social relationship, or how'd you know?
Well, it started off as a business relationship. Yeah. I wanted him to do the picture, and he was not available. He was doing Friedkin's movie, The Godfather. Mm-hmm. I mean, The Exorcist. And apparently, Bernard Herrmann came to New York to see The Exorcist with Friedkin in a screening room. And after the screening, Friedkin said, "I want you to write me a better score than you wrote for Citizen Kane." To which Bernard Herrmann replied, "Then why didn't you make a better picture than Citizen Kane?" Well, Friedkin not having any humor, that was the end of the relationship. So next thing, Warner Brothers called me and said, "Bernard Herrmann is suddenly available."
Mm.
So I called him up in London and I told him I wanted him to do the picture. He said, "Well, let me see it." So I sent him a print and he called me back and said he and his wife both liked it and they would do it. Mm. And what did I want him to do? I said, "I'm not telling you what to do. You do whatever you want to do. And I will be over there if you want me to for the recording session. And if you don't want me, I won't be there. It's up to you." So we didn't have any problems. And then maybe halfway through the scoring session, I'd call him up. I said, "You know, there's a scene where they're watching a cartoon in the living room, and it's like a Bugs Bunny cartoon. It's only for like a minute or two. Could you write some music for that?" And he said, "I don't write music for cartoons. Get yourself somebody else." And I said, "Okay, don't get excited. We don't do it. We'll use sound effects." And that was the only time we ever had any kind of any abrasive moment. And we did the picture, and then he said to me, "Now, what you have to do is come up with a title treatment, 90 seconds, and I'm going to do 90 seconds of overture to let them know what kind of movie they're going to see." Huh. And you come over the day after Christmas, which is Boxing Day, and we're going to do the recordings over there at the Cripplegate Church. Because they have a big organ and a lot of residents, and that's where I want to do this. So my wife and I went over, having made the titles, and we did them with flashlights in the basement of our house. We had, you know, 5-6 flashlights. Then they became 12. Then it became 36. Then it became 75. We overprinted, you know.
Uh-huh.
And the lights kept flashing on, beep, 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 beep. And he wrote his music. And when we got there, we brought the film in. And he had his music that he'd already recorded earlier in the day. And we put him up. And God damn it, the beats were exactly on.
Oh, that's cool.
Every time a flashlight came on, a beat came on in the movie, on the score. It was as if it had been recorded synchronous to each other. Well, after that, we were fast friends, you know. He was crazy about us. Although my wife, at the very first time we met, when we picked him up at the house where he and his wife lived, and the wife came down to wish him good luck, and he was going to the recording session, and we got in the car, and my wife said to him, "You have such a lovely daughter." And it was his wife. It was a pause, and then he started laughing.
Oh, that's great.
He said, "The world's oldest composer with the world's youngest wife." And after that, he loved her.
That's great.
And after we finished the session, he said to me, "Why don't you guys move to London for a while, and I'll take care of you and introduce you to people and make sure you have a wonderful Christmas here." And we did. We moved to London, and we lived there for a year.
Wow.
And we saw him at least three times a week, every week. If we didn't call him for 2-3 days, he'd call us up. "What's the matter? How are the children?" He just wanted to be part of the family, and we were.
Was he a storyteller? Like, was he something? Would he talk about stories of Hitchcock?
He would talk about Wells and Hitchcock and people like that. And then I saw him in New York when he did after he did the music for Obsession for Brian De Palma, and we went to a screening. And when the lights came up, there were tears streaming down his face. He'd been crying at the end of the movie. And that was the last time he'd ever see a movie that he wrote the music for, because he didn't live to see the music for Taxi Driver, because he died.
Right. Yeah, it's posthumous.
So the night he came for Taxi Driver, he recorded the session. They said there was a couple of cues left. They'd do them the next day. He said, no, let's do them tonight.
Wow.
So they did the cues, and then he came and met me over at the Goldwyn Studios. I showed him God Told Me To, which he was going to do the music for, and he took us to dinner. We took him back to the Sheraton Universal, and in the morning I got a call from Martin Scorsese that Benny had died during the night in his sleep. So we rushed over to the hotel, and there he was, lying there in the bed, with his two little hands cupped under his cheek like a little cherub, fast asleep in bed. Not a moment of panic, not a moment of discomfort. He just died so peacefully, having just finished Taxi Driver. It was a wonderful way to die.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And we took his wife to our house, and we had the funeral reception at our house, and we had everybody there for Scorsese and De Palma and De Niro and John Williams. They were there for a week.
Wow.
We were feeding everybody for a week, I'm telling you. And so it was...
Did he like God Told Me To when he watched it? I mean, if it's his last movie, you get to watch it.
It's the last movie he saw.
Did he enjoy it?
I hope it didn't kill him.
But did he enjoy it? Did he give you any feedback?
He said he loved it. It reminded me of somebody he knew in the Greenwich Village years before, who was a poet.
Wow.
The God creature.
That's incredible.
But, you know, it was... you know, the most unusual thing about the funeral was it was a small ceremony.
Yeah.
And we were sitting in the front with, you know, De Palma and De Niro and all those Scorsese. And suddenly I looked back, and there standing in the very back of the chapel was Francois Truffaut.
Uh-huh.
So I said to Benny's wife, Norma, I said, Truffaut is there in the back. So we walked to the back. She spoke fluent French, and he'd just come from the airport. And I said, please ask him if he'll come to our house for the reception afterwards. Oh, no, he said, I'm going right back to the airport. I couldn't believe it. Truffaut had flown all the way from Paris for a 45-minute ceremony and was flying all the way back to Paris again, all that way, just to pay tribute to Bernard Herrmann.
That's and deserved.
It was amazing that with somebody like him would have that much esteem that he would, you know, it's not a small trip from Paris to L.A. and back. In one day,
but it's a hell of a life career he had. It's remarkable.
So God bless him. And,
yeah,
and I have his cane. His wife gave me his cane as a memento. I have that in the house. So
I can honestly say, after we've done 170 episodes or so of our show over the course of our time, I've never had a tear in my eye until today. So that's that tells you something about the power.
Elric has a heart.
I kind of sometimes. You know, well, it only takes stories like that. But I wanted to, like, you know, kind of towards the wrapping.
What do you mean wrapping?
Well, we're just getting started. But I've already bestowed you as a genius, so now I want to talk about you being king. This is the segue dreams are made of, people. King Cohen. What is King Cohen from your perspective? King Cohen. What is this? Is this a reality show that follows you, you know, with Kanye?
What's going on with this?
It's long overdue. It's a tribute.
But you're not done yet.
I know.
You're in the prime.
Indeed I am. But I enjoyed it that I was approached by some wonderful people who said they wanted to make a documentary about my career. And
they're sitting in the room with us.
All the innovative things that have happened. And... they said a lot of people wanted to contribute, people who worked on the films, and people like Martin Scorsese and J.J. Abrams, who admired the films, and Rick Baker, who got his start on the films and did some of the greatest makeups. And so there were some very fine actors in the pictures, and they appear in the documentary. And there are clips from my movies and some of the stories. So I think it's a very worthwhile film, and tells you a lot about making independent movies. I must say, I don't think anybody has made them more independent than I have.
Mm.
I mean,
what was the most loose of all your films? What was the one where you're really just the most indie, like you can't believe you're getting away with even shooting this thing on the streets?
Well, the Chrysler Building in Q was certainly Nobody knew we were going to be firing machine guns off the top of the Chrysler building.
Oh, man.
And to tell you the truth, if we did it today, we'd probably be in jail.
Oh, well, yeah.
With
for
all
sure.
the terrorism I mean. Today. As it was, somebody reported that people were firing on the United Nations building, which is also on 42nd Street on the east side. So it wasn't true, but there was a lot of panicking around. And we made the front pages of all the New York newspapers. Hollywood crew terrorizes New York.
So, you need that one framed.
It wasn't true, however, because I'd sent a camera crew down to the street to see if there was going to be any reaction to the machine gunning. And people just walked by and looked up and kept going. Nobody panicked. Otherwise, they would have been in the movie. I can guarantee you that. I would have taken pictures of them. But the thing about that movie was I had been doing another movie called I, the Jury, which was based on a Mickey Spillane novel. Oh, yeah. And I was directing the picture. I had bought the book and developed the script and had trouble with the producers right away. Because every time I tried to do something like I do, right away they were panicking, you know. So after a week, I said, well, this is not going to work. And we parted company. So everybody said, well, now, what's he going to do now? He's been fired off a movie. But the next day, I started shooting Q.
Huh.
The very next day, I was out with the crew. I'd hired Al Cirillo, the best helicopter camera person in the business, who did Superman and all the other great stuff in the air. And we were up shooting the very next day. The actors came in within 2 days. And 3 days later, we were shooting the whole movie at full speed. And the people from either jury couldn't believe it. We finished 2 or 3 weeks ahead of them they went over budget to about $7 or $8 million. We made our picture for about $1 million. And some months later, both movies opened on Broadway at the same day.
Oh, wow.
We opened at the Rivoli, they opened at the National. And we did 3 times the business they did. And got all the good reviews, too. So
you killed Shaft. Yeah. You killed Shaft in your movie. Yeah, David Carradine in there. It's
so loaded. Whatever it was, it all worked out very much for the best. But for a moment there, you know, you say, what am I going to do now? I've been fired from a movie. What am I going to do? I did it to myself, you know. And
I think the lesson is make your own luck, you know.
It sounds like that's what you've been doing your whole career. Jump right back on the horse and go again. And people say, how could you make a movie with 1 day preparation? I said, I didn't have 1 day. And we started the next day. So,
have they finished the documentary? Are you still adding to it? Like,
I think it's all done. There's a few musical cues left.
Okay.
Oh, wow.
And you know, I can't wait to see it myself.
Yeah, yeah.
Nice.
And we'll find out more for you. We'll post some information.
King
keep
Cohen,
people up to
you know. Yeah.
King Cohen.
King
Cohen.
Yeah.
King Cohen.
Yeah.
King
that's what I'm saying. We started with genius. Now you're just king. But hail to the king.
You know what happens to kings, though, usually. you know what fate beholds them.
Yeah.
So, if you want to be there for the beheading, it's perfectly all right with me. That's the last scene in the documentary, actually, when I'm actually beheaded.
And one of them will whisper, God told me to.
Yeah, that's the way it is. Sometimes you can't help it. You have to fulfill your destiny.
Yeah. Well,
at least I didn't fall off the Chrysler building.
Yeah.
Did you even have to go up there?
Oh, you're
up the
that
top of it?
I was really shot up 88 stories above the street. There's a little ladder about as wide as, a couple of inches wide. That's the only way to get up there. You have to climb up this flimsy ladder. And then the crew has to climb up after you, which I didn't think they would probably do, but they did. And then you have to hoist all the cameras and all the lights and all the props and the skeletons and everything has to be hoisted up on ropes. And you set the whole thing up. And then we wanted pigeons, so we had to hire a pigeon wrangler who came in with pigeons. And they were homing pigeons that went back to New Jersey after they did their scene.
Huh. Now, was this like crazy hard to coordinate with permits? Because I assume the Chrysler building.
No permits at all for this.
None. Did the natural history, is that where you did the final shot? Did they make you get permits as well?
No.
Or no?
I can't wait to see this documentary.
Oh, yeah.
We shot overhead going into the National History.
Yeah, that's what I'm remembering it was like the rooftop.
No, there was one place that was burned up and the roof was off of it. I don't know what the hell it was. And then the egg chamber, however, that was in there, that was a mock-up. That was a miniature.
Okay.
And that's the same shot that was used in the remake of Godzilla. They stole the same ending from me. You know? The last shot in the movie is the egg, and then it breaks open. That's the same ending that they put into Godzilla, which costs about 400 times more than my movie.
Wow. Well, we'll be pitching you for the Halloween remake. We're at Blumhouse. There's no one I would rather see remake that movie, and it would be less predictable than anything anyone could do. So.
Well, that's certainly for sure that would be unpredictable.
It would be unpredictable, which I invite. So, yeah, we'll look out for King Cohen, people. We will update you on that. We're excited about it. Really good team behind it who are all nodding their head at that.
Yes.
Yes, they're smiling at us right now.
We mean it.
And, you know, it's always more than a pleasure, Larry. It really is. It's inspiring, and it excites me about the art, you know, yeah. Even just having a conversation with
it. Inspired me too, to tell you the truth. Makes me want to go out and make another movie.
Or start a coffee shop.
Do it. Or fund a coffee shop.
Hey, well, yeah, exactly.
Movie about a coffee shop.
As a matter of fact, I just wrote a screenplay called Caffeine.
Oh, yeah.
This all takes place in like a Starbucks.
Oh.
And the whole story is that a rash of terrorist explosions are going out around the city of New York, and they're all being engineered from a computer on a table inside a Starbucks.
Ah, again, going for the banal evil. I like
coffee
it.
Coffee is the...
yeah.
That's how the bombs got distributed around the country and around the city, is that they've killed the Starbucks delivery man, and they put the bombs in the Starbucks cartons and surrounded by coffee so the dogs can't smell the explosives because of the coffee. And they delivered them to a series of Starbucks-type places around the city, and then they can automatically detonate them from inside the coffee shop.
Well, if you can't use Starbucks as your logo, feel free to. You can have jump cuts.
It's called Caffeine Cafe. That's
okay. Yeah, we'll keep it generic. That's good.
Anyway, there you are. You picked my most recent script.
Yeah, so we got a good plug at the end.
That's pretty good. Well, thank you so much for being so generous with your time and coming to talk to us.
That's all right. I'm not going home.
He's waiting here to pitch tomorrow.
I like it here. What time is Mr. Blum coming in? Yeah,
a few hours, I think.
Yeah.
And I'm going to title this episode All Hail King Cohen.
Let's do it.
That's right. Thank you very much once again, all of you.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.